And you can tell that they're starting to rekindle that romance
mm-hmm.
as a function of her dalliance with Hulk.
Yeah. Hulk. Right. Right.
Welcome to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Sincast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined as always by the voice of CinemaSins, Jeremy Scott.
Hello!
And from Music Video Sins, Barrett Sher.
I am here.
And we have a very special guest today.
Yes, we do.
Hello.
Dave Irwin is here in the studio.
Woo-hoo!
A little background about yourself?
I don't know much.
Yeah.
But I know movies.
Mm-hmm. But I know how
you know
I
movies. Yeah, yeah. I was about to say. I was like, here it comes. Here it comes.
We don't do enough Aaron Neville on this podcast.
I do a great Aaron Neville.
Yes, you know movies. I know you as someone who constantly goes to theaters.
Constantly.
And it's always
no life.
And even though I hate Facebook, I occasionally will go on Facebook and I'll see, you know,
me bitching about something,
something
that
yes.
I just saw.
All right. Yeah. Right. Today, so last month we had a comment in Facebook, ironically enough. I don't hate you guys. I hate the medium. Was asking if we would do an LGBTQ themed episode because was it Pride Month last month?
It was
two months ago.
Yeah.
It was 2 months ago.
Yeah, it was.
And we at the time,
you guys are a little late.
Yeah. Well, we at the time were in the middle of doing about 6 or 7 episodes of this podcast and had gotten done with most of them through July. and so we didn't have time to do one, but we figured, why does it have to be a month?
That's right.
Why do we have to do it in June?
Yep.
We can do it anytime. Why don't we do it in August? Okay, that's what we're going to do then. So this is going to be kind of a freeform discussion. But one thing, I saw a movie recently that came out in the 90s called The Celluloid Closet.
Yes.
And we both discussed this movie a little bit before. It's a little dated now.
A little.
Yeah.
it's
more than
dated.
More than a little. But in that movie, they discuss, like, basically the evolution / devolution of the depiction of LGBTQ community
mm-hmm.
in these movies. When it first started off before the Hays Code,
right,
there was this sort of like, okay, we can do whatever we want.
Yeah, yeah.
But then the Hays Code came in and they basically shut all of that out. And then anybody who was shown as gay, they would never say the words,
no.
But they would make it where people in the Midwest knew.
Yeah, it became a certain stereotype. Like
mm-hmm.
in the 20s, like you said, they could do whatever they wanted in movies. In fact, heterosexual men could even be affectionate towards other heterosexual men and it was okay. But still back then in the silent films of the 20s, if you were a gay character, you were, basically what they called the sissy,
mm-hmm.
somebody with limp wrists who would prance around, always bitchy or always considered a coward.
Yeah.
The Hays Code came around and, that came out of what the Motion Picture Production Code, I want to say it was, a politician from Indiana. You didn't know you were getting a history lesson.
A postmaster general.
Yes, named William Hays,
yeah.
who was the campaign manager for
Harding, I think.
Warren G. Harding, and got him elected. And then 2 years after he was in his cabinet, he resigned and became chairman of the Motion Picture Production and Directors Association. And then kind of enlisted this production code along with the Catholic Church and the quote unquote League of Human Decency to where we were going to eliminate profanity, nudity, other ridiculous things like open mouth kissing
mm-hmm.
from movies, lustful embraces.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing was sexual perversion because they didn't really have a term for homosexual
mm-hmm.
back then. It was sexual perversion. So in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, early 50s, you saw none of that. And so everything was pretty much censored. and the gay characters were represented, like I said, as sissies. Lesbian characters were butch or jail wardens or pimps or prostitutes, what have you. There's a good quote in that documentary that says, Hollywood was teaching straight people what to think about gay people and teaching gay people what to think about themselves at the time. So in that time, gay people, gay characters were a punchline. Then you get into the 60s and 70s where gay characters are to be pitied. And then you get into the late 70s, early 80s where gay characters are the victimizers and murderers and something to fear. So in a nutshell, that's what that documentary, The Celluloid Closet, is about. Just the history of gay representation in films from the early days. Thank God, since that documentary came out, things have changed in cinema with LGBT characters. A good example would just be films like Booksmart from this year. And even Love, Simon from last year, where it's just being gay is a completely non-issue.
I loved Love, Simon so much.
It was a great movie.
Yeah, it was.
I called it the gay John Hughes film.
There you go.
But even Booksmart was probably one of my favorite films of this year because, you know, you've got these two best friends, one of which is gay. Her best friend, Beanie Feldstein, is very supportive of her. All of they're partying with the popular kids, the geeks, the drama nerds, everybody. You know, there's not a disparaging comment about anybody's sexuality in the whole movie. And it makes me hopeful for the future.
Yeah.
I remember going to see Love, Simon last year with one of my good friends, Tiffany. And Tiffany was just, and I were just looking around the theater at all these cute little gay and lesbian teenagers who came to the film to see this movie, and they're holding hands, and I thought, God, 25 years ago that would have been me, but I didn't have this, you know. And it's just amazing how far we've come in that short amount of time.
Even in the 90s, I mean, you think about like what's a cultural touchstone for, besides maybe The Celluloid Closet, that that would connect with gay teenagers.
Yeah.
There weren't any for teenagers, for sure.
No, there
were several, like Priscilla, Queen of the Desert,
that
came out, I believe, in 94.
Mid-90s was a big renaissance for drag queen movies. That movie, Tuong Fu, The Birdcage, to a certain extent. For me, you know, I was in high school from 1990 to 1994. I'm old. And going to Blockbuster, being in Blockbuster for 2 hours, scouring each individual genre, trying to find something that might be a little bit gay, that might talk to me. The foreign film section was my friend back then. Pedro Almodovar. The early 90s had a renaissance of what they call new wave queer cinema, where gay filmmakers were making movies about themselves, making movies about gay and lesbian characters who were kind of rejecting heteronormativity and living outside of the confines of normal society at the time. Greg Araki was doing it. Derek Jarman was doing some great movies back then. Gus Van Sant.
He did My Own Private Idaho, right?
Which is the movie. I could go off for hours about this movie, but I won't. I promise. I won't worry. That was the movie that I saw, which after I saw it, I knew I was gay. I had.
River Phoenix does that to people.
He really does. He really did. And to a certain extent, Keanu.
Yeah, that's true.
God bless Keanu. I remember watching that movie, and I had feelings towards boys and men when I was, you know, really young. And I knew I was attracted to men, but I remember watching My Own Private Idaho, and after it was over, recognizing that that was me, that I was a gay man, and like putting a label on myself, and then rewinding it. VHS, God, how old are you, Dave? Rewinding the movie and wanting it and watching it over again and wanting the ending to be different, but knowing it wasn't going to be different. And just wanting so much that feeling that River was projecting towards his friend who was not necessarily reciprocating those emotions which later became the story of my life.
Yeah, because they end up, not to spoil the movie, but they end up, one of them's in Rome, right? And then the other one goes back to the U.S.?
Well, they both go to Rome to find River Phoenix's character's mother, because they've been told that's where she's gone off to. And they go and they find out she's not there. River comes back, but the whole basis of this movie is it's kind of a retelling of Henry IV and Henry V, where Keanu is sleeping with men on the street. He comes from a very affluent, wealthy family. I think his dad's a politician or something like that. But he's sleeping with these men on the street, and he's just basically biding his time before he inherits a shit ton of money from his dad. And so I think River's character knows that his time with Keanu's character is limited, because once he inherits all this money, I mean, that's it. He's leaving the streets. He's leaving his friends, leaving the lifestyle. And inevitably that's what happens. So where was I going?
No, sorry. It had a big impact on you.
It had a huge impact on me. More so than any gay themed film during that time. Like I said, I was going to Blockbuster, renting all of these movies. But it was that one that had such a profound influence on me. I still didn't come out of the closet till for another a good 6 or 7 years later, to my parents at least. But I felt comfortable at that moment to come out to everybody else, to friends and all the people I was close to. So that film was my biggest epiphany, I guess, in the time and during that time.
Yeah. But so sort of, and we're just we're going back over some ground here. You know, we're talking about the celluloid closet, and you know, and I'm not saying that we got off track. I don't want anybody to think that we did that. Right. You know, whatever. Just when I say this, but there were some things that you had brought up as sort of an overview with that movie that I wanted to also bring up that. You know, they talked about like how some characters, they never really said that they were gay.
Right.
And they would do things that would make it seem like, especially the and I don't remember the character name in Rebel Without a Cause, who
Plato.
Yeah.
Salminio's character.
Right. Who's in love with the James Dean character and everything. And
he's got a picture of Alan Ladd in his locker.
Picture of Alan Ladd in his locker.
Yeah. So you know.
Yeah. They give you clues and everything, but his character met a fate that so many would in this, because they weren't allowed to live by the end of these movies.
No.
They were almost always killed somehow, some way.
And suicide.
Or committed suicide, which is I saw this movie on TCM a long time ago. The what is it called? The Children's Hour.
Shirley MacLaine.
Yeah, Shirley MacLaine and Audrey Hepburn.
Yes.
And a little girl sees them in some sort of an embrace and takes it the wrong way and tells someone about it. And it basically sort of ruins Shirley MacLaine's life. And they were talking about how even in this 90s thing, they're talking about how, yeah, you wouldn't show a character like Shirley MacLaine, you know, just kind of like so wrought with guilt over all this, because she really does have feelings for Audrey Hepburn, but the embrace was nothing.
No.
And so she's just got this guilt in her, and she's like beating herself up over it and everything. But yeah, in that one, it's got a big, huge, you know, suicide scene and everything. And so they showed this sort of in a montage, and I was like, holy crap, that's so true. The funny ones though are the ones where they got away with a whole bunch of stuff, in Spartacus.
What did they get away with in Spartacus?
You might probably tell it better than me.
Okay. So it's been forever since I've seen Spartacus, but, that was the one with Tony Curtis. That's when he becomes the body servant to the king.
And they had to cut a scene, even though it was sort of like in code. They had to cut a scene where the guy that Tony Curtis is servicing in this, but he says something to the effect that he likes both oysters and snails.
Exactly.
Huh. And they had to cut that.
Wow. I like both.
Yeah, I like both of them.
Just so you know what you're in for.
Yeah.
As my body servant.
Right, right. They had to cut that. But
all the machinations and craziness.
And there's scenes with Montgomery Clift and I can't remember the other actor.
Red River,
where they're comparing guns.
Where they're comparing guns. It's John Ireland is the other actor, and they're comparing guns as if they're comparing cock sizes. But there's another scene, because that's one of my favorite movies, that they don't talk about in that documentary, where these characters have been traveling for days and days and days, and the sexually frustrated scene where Montgomery Clift picks up a horny toad off the ground and just hands it to John Ireland, gives him a look. And John Ireland looks back at Montgomery Clift and gives him that same knowing look. It's like, yeah, we're both fucking horny.
Yeah.
So, let's do something.
Yeah.
They got away with a lot. Hitchcock especially.
Yes.
There's something gay in almost every single Hitchcock film. But also during that time, they would also take books that had gay characters and adapt them for films and erase the gay subplot or main
right.
plot, what altogether. You were talking about The Children's Hour. They actually did an earlier film of that called These Three, where instead of the two women having an affair, they made it a love triangle between a man and two women.
Oh, that's right.
So,
yeah.
And I can't remember what the name of the other movie was where they, instead of a gay character being persecuted, they made it a Jewish character being persecuted. You know, they would do shit like that just to avoid the topic of sex perversion.
Right.
Back in those days. So.
And then the Hays Code started to soften a bit in the 60s. It wasn't completely out, but they would still put in characters, but they were always, there was, they showed one movie that I don't remember the one thing the Celluloid Closet is awful at is showing titles of the movies
I hate that.
You kind of have to figure it out yourself.
Yeah. And they may bring it up.
Thank God for Google.
Right. You may bring it up, but there was one movie. I think it was a guy who helped write On the Waterfront, or he was involved with it in some way. And it was some movie about the docks, something about there was some seedy, a guy who's very curious about it goes out to the docks and he sees these men holding hands. This is in the 60s.
Yeah, yeah.
Men holding hands, kissing, all that. And then he goes into a bar of some sort and it's sort of like this stark thing about how they light the bar and everybody's in shadows. Mm-hmm. And this is all just very seedy and very, very, you don't want to do this. You don't want to be like this guy. And this guy obviously is gay, but it's something to be feared all the way through and everything.
I think that's advice and consent.
Advice and consent. Okay.
I think at least the one with the gay bar.
Yeah.
I think the one with the docs is a different movie. But advice and consent is a political movie, and I hate political movies, and it's very convoluted, but long story short, one of the characters is being blackmailed by the government and basically is confronting the guy that he had sex with who sold his story to the tabloids at this gay bar, this like seedy, darkly lit gay bar.
Mm-hmm.
And the other guy recognizes him and goes out and says, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. They, you know, I needed the money, blah, blah, blah." And he kind of just gets in a cab and throws this guy's head into the gutter.
Yeah.
So I think that's that movie, Advice and Consent.
Mm-hmm.
But again, something to be pitied, suicide, death, or living a miserable life. That was the outcome of gay characters back in those days.
Mm.
But one movie that they talk about that sort of brought on a brief resurgence, and I don't know if you've ever seen this, William Friedkin's The Boys in the Band.
I have.
You've
I
seen
have
this?
Seen it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But again, it was applauded for being a movie that normalized gay men and especially gay friendships back in those days. It was the first time you really saw a community of gay men coming together. That one takes place, I think they're throwing a birthday party for one of their friends.
Is that in the 70s?
It's 1970, I do believe. Yeah. It's like right at 1970.
Because he did Cruisin'.
Which we'll get to.
And that's another part of the celluloid closet. It's talking about how this movie comes out. Now, mm-hmm. are you saying there's some negative connotations to Boys in the Band now?
The good thing about that was it's normalization of and humanization of these gay men. But still, at the end of the movie, they end up, or at least the main character ends up, completely miserable. Mm. They're actually remaking it, I think, on Netflix with I think Zachary Quinto and Matt Bomer and Jim Parsons and I think Andrew Reynolds, all the hot gay actors.
They're actually gay actors.
Yeah.
So maybe that ending will be a little more upbeat.
Yeah, I'm not sure how big of a hit The Boys in the Band was, but the 70s then brought along the, well, now that this is normal, let's turn them into villains and things. So there's a James Caan movie that they show.
Freebie and the Bean.
It's
a buddy comedy. Whoa. A buddy cop movie. Back in the 70s. Yeah. The killer is a they called it transvestite back then. It's a trans man or trans woman.
Yeah, and they're talking about how sort of the glee the movie takes with him shooting.
Yeah.
Just like one bullet would have been enough. Because
you're not only shooting the bad guy, you're shooting the homosexual.
Yes. And they said that, you would be in this theater and people would be cheering because, hey, the villain, but you're really also cheering the fact that this is a trans person and we're getting rid of that we're eradicating it and so on. It's way over the top how many times he shoots her, too.
Wow.
It's crazy.
What is it called again?
Freebie and the Bean.
Yeah.
Don't you just want to watch it based on that title, though?
Yeah. And there's another one that shows like a couple of hitchhikers who want to rob the guy in the car.
Oh, yeah. I can't remember the name of that one.
And that's another one where, they get their just desserts, get beat up and thrown out and all that.
What about Diamonds Are Forever? With the two gay guys who are attempting to kill James Bond.
Oh, yeah.
My God. I forgot all about that.
Oh, wow.
I can't remember what their name, Mr. Something and Mr. Something.
Yes.
I can't even remember.
Oh, man.
It's been
those guys, since I've seen it. They were genuinely creepy on screen.
Yes, yes.
But they were meant to be, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But this leads into Cruisin', which...
Cruisin', 1980.
Yeah, which Al Pacino... and I've never seen this movie. I saw one scene from it where it was basically this violent encounter outside of a bar. Mm-hmm. What was the deal with Cruising?
Cruising is a film where there's a series of murders in the gay community in New York, especially during the leather scene in New York. And Al Pacino is a police officer who's enlisted to go undercover as a gay man. And go into all of these quote unquote seedy gay places and see if he can find this murderer. It has an ambiguous ending. I think it's a good movie. Mm. Now, looking back on it, at the time, I could see why LGBT people were protesting it because they thought at the time, and maybe rightfully so, that it was, exploiting gay culture, that it was saying that all gay people were murderers and that they were showing the sex that goes on in these leather clubs as something that was just shocking and that gay people were just dirty and perverted and vile. And, so I think that's what they were protesting more so than anything, not actually maybe not really the plot of the movie itself or anything. But it's an interesting film. It's very divisive amongst the gay community.
Pacino is very good in it, though.
Pacino is very good
in
it.
So
you've seen it?
Yes.
Okay.
It's been a while, but this is after, of course, Godfathers and stuff like that, after Dog Day Afternoon, after Serpico, but pre, obviously Carlito's Way and all that stuff. So he's really in his prime right now. And, he's really good.
It's like 1980, I think.
Yeah. It's right, 1980.
Yeah. Okay. Gonna just randomly do something here. Jeremy, I know that you've been sitting there sort of like listening and I Do you have any movies you want to bring up and talk
about?
I do.
Jeremy, you've been awfully quiet on this topic. The thoughts going through my head. Well, first of all, I very recently watched Boy Erased on HBO.
Ooh, Lucas Hedges, Russell Crowe.
Yes, although I did not know Russell Crowe and Nicole Kidman were in it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just thought, what's his name?
Lucas Hedges.
Lucas Hedges. That was the only actor's name I knew going in. I had already seen Miseducation of Cameron Post. Mm-hmm. They came out the same year, dealing with similar topics.
Yes. Right, right.
But the Miseducation of Cameron Post feels ultimately like a high school movie
mm-hmm.
that just happens to have this plot through it, whereas Boy Erased is a much more dramatic, hard to watch in some places.
There's much more of a sense of urgency.
There is. And see, now my,
to get out.
My dad was a preacher. In what would at the time have been considered an evangelical denomination. And this was a fascinating movie for me to watch, just as sort of seeing how much of my own parents might be reflected here. Is this what would have happened in my life if I had come out to my parents as gay? Would they have sent me to a place like this? I like that the movie ends with a hint of reconciliation. I like that Russell Crowe's, you know, father, he's not, he has some scenes where you really don't like this guy, but
no.
I didn't feel like they stopped loving him or didn't love their son. They just wanted a different thing for him. Also super distracting if you watch them in the order I did, because this movie has a character named Cameron at the gay conversion place.
Oh, really?
Like, they say his name three or four times in the opening, and I'm like, ah, it's the same. So that movie is fresh on my mind. Great performances.
It is good.
I would recommend that over Cameron Post every day of the week.
Oh, yeah, Cameron Post.
And I mean, I don't think, I wasn't offended by Cameron Post.
No.
I just didn't feel like it took the topic as seriously as Boy Erased. So I was anxious to see it as soon as I saw it was coming on HBO. I watched. Now, have you guys seen that?
I haven't. I remember it coming out and I wanted to see it, but is it Netflix or did it come
HBO.
Out in theater?
Oh,
it was in the theater.
It was in Belcourt last year.
Okay. So I missed it when it came to the theaters then. But yeah, I have to watch that. So thumbs up.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, obviously not the subject matter, but well, movie itself.
Yeah, not what he goes through, but I think that is that's a real thing, right? Like, he goes on at the end to write an article about sort of exposing what the gay conversion therapy is really all about. It made me wonder if this was loosely based on a real person's experience. Mm.
It was, actually.
Was it really?
Mm-hmm.
I would like to read more about that person or more of what they might have written.
Yeah, it's basically a true story.
Yeah.
I agree with you. It was a great movie.
Yeah.
I did identify with it more than the Miseducation of Cameron Post. Now, I will say that the Miseducation of Cameron Post, I think maybe having conversations with my best friend Tiffany, who's a lesbian, she identified with that movie more than she did with Boy Erased. So maybe that's a gender thing.
It could be.
There. But like I said, there was more of a sense of urgency with him needing to get out of this conversion therapy.
Yeah.
Whereas with Cameron Post, it's like they could basically
they walked
have left
the fuck
any,
out of there.
Yeah,
dude.
Yeah.
They just like, hey,
just left.
We're in the woods.
They just got in the truck and
yeah,
left.
Seriously.
I mean, there were some horrible people at that conversion therapy camp, but still, you know, not as horrible as Flea was in Boy Erased.
Yeah.
And great performances.
It was much better experience for me to watch that than the other. I just felt there were times with Cameron Post where the filmmakers weren't sure what they were trying to say. Are we making jokes? Is this a serious drama?
Yep.
We'll do a little bit of each. Whereas Boy Erased knew what it wanted to be all the way through.
Yeah. The director of Cameron Post is a very talented woman named Desiree Akhavan. She had a web series back in 2010, 2011 called The Slope, and it was basically that web series was about superficial homophobic lesbians. And I highly recommend, it's one of the most hilarious things I've ever seen. So maybe I think that's where she was coming from when she did Cameron Post. She was wanting to inject some of that comedy
okay.
into that situation.
Yeah, yeah. It almost got there, but it made it ultimately confusing, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah. If she had leaned into that a little bit more, I think that would have been good.
Yeah.
Because I like me some Chloe Grace.
Mm-hmm. She's a great actress.
She is,
she's
and she's good in that.
I also think a lot about Friends. The TV show.
Yeah.
Do you really?
How progressive was Friends?
Not at all.
No, yeah,
like
not at all.
Like, they do a lot of the stuff that you were talking about back in the 20s and 30s about, like, if it's a lesbian, she's butch. Like, I brought this joke up on the podcast before where Ross goes to his ex-wife's house and picks up a picture and says, "When did you meet Bruce Springsteen?" And the now lesbian wife says, "That's our friend Kelly," or whatever.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That Friends is full of that. Like, I love the show, but there are episodes that are hard for me to watch. There's a lot of Chandler stuff where he's afraid to be seen as anything close to gay. He and Joey hug too long, and they go, "Oh, maybe we should do." There's a whole run where Chandler keeps not understanding manly things, and everybody keeps telling him he needs to watch ESPN more. And what's crazy to me, one of the things for me, maybe I'll write a book about this one day. I feel like there was a holy triumvirate of sitcoms in the 90s, Friends, Frasier, and Seinfeld. Mm-hmm. And I'm always looking for connections. And Seinfeld, which came first, is almost more progressive in how they handled, like, gay storylines. 100%.
100%. Now, it wasn't always good. Now, the classic example is not that there's anything wrong with that type of thing, which at the time I think was progressive. But then, you know, you've got the whole Susan and her running off after George and basically doing the same thing as Friends.
Yes.
And hooking up with a lesbian. And then there's just little things in there where it's not completely there, but like the beard episode where Elaine converts somebody for like a night and then he goes back. And
I will say, though, what you in Friends, you also had, though, I think it's from the very first episode, Ross's wife has left him for another woman, and they're going to raise the kid together. I mean, it has moments where where it seems like it's probably in the 90s, right on the edge, right?
It was on the cusp.
Yeah. But it wasn't. It still had those hangups, like Chandler. You know, there's a whole episode with Chandler. I could have gotten this guy in the other department or whatever, and he's like, no, and everybody's like, no, you couldn't have possibly gotten that guy.
Yeah,
and
he's out of your league.
Yeah, yeah.
There's the episode where Monica and Chandler lie to everybody to go on a romantic getaway, and when they get back, Joey says, "Were you or were you not on a gay cruise?" Like, the show is peppered with tone deaf stuff, but it is progressive in other ways. And I think Frasier was also, correct me if I'm wrong, I think they handled those topics better than Friends did. Am I wrong? You're looking at me like I'm wrong.
No, you go right ahead. I'm with you. I'm with you here.
One of the most famous episodes of Frasier is where he invites his new boss back home, and his new boss is gay and thinks that Frasier is gay, and the hilarity that ensues from that misunderstanding. There are a handful of episodes that do that. There's one episode. Are you a Frasier fan?
Mm-hmm.
There's one episode where they go to the opera, and Frasier, I think it's the gal from CSI Las Vegas, the redhead. Anyway, he wants to hit on this girl, but she's with her mom and her gay uncle. And they all end up coming back to Frasier's apartment, and through however it happens, Martin, Frasier's dad, has to pretend to be gay because they're acting like they're setting up the uncle with Martin. And Martin's like, "Oh, I'll gay it up a little bit." But I still never felt like that was insulting. And again, I only have my own perspective. So one of the things that we're learning throughout talking about all this is the ways that we've been shaped to react to certain things like this. But Friends is murky for me, man. I'll laugh my ass off one episode. The next episode, I'm like,
now you got a brain that's 20 years wiser at this point.
Yeah,
that's like, you know, we were talking about celluloid closet. A guy is sitting there talking about how people will use the N word, and he says the full word.
Oh my God!
Whereas, you know, you would never do that, even if you're making a point today. You would never do that, but
unless you're Viggo Mortensen.
Yeah, unless you're Viggo Mortensen.
Did he do that?
He said nobody says N word anymore, but he said the word. He apologized for it. It was promoting the Green Book.
I can't remember that.
So it was very recent.
Fuck, dude.
It was very recent.
The fuck?
Mahershala Ali was like, "Oh, buddy, no."
here's some even more far away tangent stuff. Did you see the John Oliver where there was a reporter that was chasing after a guy, and he's like, did you say the N-word, but he doesn't say N-word and everything. And the guy he's chasing is the real villain and everything. And Oliver talks about that guy. But he's like, oh, by the way, that reporter, you know, you don't get to say that word just because you're accusing him of this or whatever. He's like, the only white guy who can say the N-word is this guy here in Maine. And blah, blah, blah. And it's like, but he never says it. And that's the, and that's the point.
I love John Oliver.
I don't even know what the original point was, but that's fine. That's totally fine.
I think what we were talking about is the ways that we've been shaped to not even realize that the things we're saying or doing mm-hmm. are offensive.
Yeah.
Like, I was talking with my wife, because we recently did a Sins video where, oh, it was Monster House, where mm-hmm. they did the Ding Dong Ditch.
Yeah.
And I was like, let's try to forget the extremely racist name that this game used to have, mm-hmm. if that's even possible. And we were talking about another one we just did, No More Monkeys Jumping on the Bed.
Oh.
And
even Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe.
And these things were taught to me by my mother, who I guarantee you had no idea that there were racist origins. And that's how this shit works, man. Generationally, it takes generations to unlearn that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah.
I think the 80s decade had the monopoly on the word faggot back in...
Oh, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. Eddie Murphy in almost every movie. They show 48 Hours.
Oh, yeah.
They show a brief part, but he says it in Trading Places, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, of course, his stand-up specials.
48 Hours is... problematic everywhere.
Yeah. But they have a whole montage showing how just thrown around, and that's what that guy was talking about when he said the N-word and I've never heard anybody say the F-word like that. And he's talking about the proper use when there's two black
people.
And it
was everywhere. John Hughes, David Lynch, you know, all everybody. It was almost like... It's like how people these days say, well, I didn't mean, when I say that's gay, I mean, it's lame, you know?
Right.
It's kind of silly and ridiculous. I'm not meaning that it's, you know, gay. And it's like, well, the connotation is there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The intent is there. Whether or not you meant it to be offensive, you know, it's still there.
There was a commercial with Wanda Sykes that came out a few years, I don't know how many years ago, where it's a bunch of kids in a restaurant or cafe or something throwing gay around as a you know, euphemism for lame or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And she comes in and she's like, what are you using that word for? And you can't just throw that around like that. And he said, what if I said, and she picked something appearance wise off of this. What if everybody said 15-year-old crackhead or whatever? Whatever. I don't know what it is that she picks off of him appearance wise, but what if everybody went around saying that about, wouldn't you get offended about it and everything?
Right.
I was at lunch with my wife 2 days ago and Money for Nothing came on the radio at a restaurant. Yeah. And I was like, man, I might want to pull this one out of the rotation.
Well, it's usually edited on the radio these
days.
This
one was not.
Was it not? Wow.
And I've heard it on satellite radio edited too.
One of the most celebrated scenes of the 40-year-old virgin was Seth Rogen and Paul Rudd doing the whole, you know how I know you're gay.
Yeah.
And
to his credit, I believe Seth Rogen has a couple times spoken out about regretting.
Has he really?
That and not being old enough or wise enough to know in the moment that would be offensive to people.
That's the perfect representation. That wasn't that long ago.
Let me ask you something. Back in 2005, when that movie came out, did you find that scene super offensive, or did you find it funny in any way?
Yeah, talking about the 40-year-old version?
Yeah.
You know, a little bit of both, you know.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, you know, we're conditioned to, yeah, this is the norm in movies.
Mm-hmm.
Gay people are always going to be made fun of in a way. I remember taking it back to the celluloid closet, sorry.
Yeah.
How so many commentators said that they didn't like the sissy, but Harvey Fierstein said, I liked the sissy.
Right.
Because my opinion was visibility at any cost.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Hmm. Yeah.
Hmm. Now that's interesting, given his role in like Mrs. Doubtfire.
Right.
He identifies with Sissy. He's like, I'm a sissy, is what he says.
Yeah, he says, I'm a sissy, and I'm proud of it, you know?
Yeah. I always wonder how those play. Like, is it just like sort of an immediate, like, oh, this is just horrible and offensive? Or are you just kind of like, ha-ha, you know, that type of thing?
There's a little bit like that as a gay man in the theater when the gay jokes come up. But like Christopher Guest's characters, like especially in Waiting for Guffman or Best in Show, the gay characters are so effeminate, so outrageous. But at the same time, they are completely proud of who they are. So while the jokes might be offensive to some, for people like me, it's like, do what you need to do. You just be you.
Know? Yeah. So, no, they do play up. It's a caricature, but it's not like it doesn't seem like a mean-spirited caricature, right? Like Michael McKean and John Michael Higgins.
Right, and there's a bunch of deleted scenes from Best in Show with Michael McKean and John Michael Higgins that I wish they would have included in the film.
Oh, yeah?
Where they are, you know, Michael McKean is afraid that John Michael Higgins is being too flamboyant and that they're going to get their asses kicked. And so in response to that, John Michael Higgins just plants a big kiss on Michael McKean, and he looks around like, oh my God, who's going to kick our asses? Oh my God. It's just like, lighten up and be yourself.
Yeah. So one thing that I found striking in the celluloid closet, though, was how, and there's this woman that has a lot of interview time in the movie, but I don't know her name because they didn't ever show the names.
So bad at that.
But she was talking about how you know, renting movies and watching movies and everything, how much that she would look for gay subtext anything in any movie.
I've done that my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even with things like Star Wars, you know.
Right.
And, you know, if you guys ever do a whole episode on Star Wars, please count me in because that's my specialty.
Okay.
That's my obsession. But, you know, yeah, being a kid and being a teenager, just finding the little things. And I think I know who you're talking about, that documentary. Yeah, I called up a friend and I said, there's this great kind of lesbian subplot in this film. Okay, but they're vampires, but still, you know. But it's because gay people back then were starved for depictions of themselves, you know.
Yeah.
There was hardly any representation, you know. I would say up until the mid-80s when films like Parting Glances and Desert Hearts came out, which kind of made gay people started showing stories of gay people in a positive light and sexuality in a positive light, that we didn't have to really search anymore, you know. Mm-hmm. And slowly since then, even I think the late 90s is when like the gay boom just went like, you know, full tilt boogie.
The gay boom.
The gay boom, Velvet Goldmine, Wild, that horrible 54 film that Harvey Weinstein chopped to bits because he didn't like all the gay shit or the bisexual shit.
Oh, is that really was that a main issue in that? Because that movie was horrible.
Which movie?
It was horrible.
The Ryan Phillippe.
The theatrical film was horrible. Studio 54. They recently released a director's cut. That is so much better.
Really?
Wow. Oh, really?
It's still a bad movie, but it's so much better with the way it was intended to be edited and presented.
I always am incredulous about that stuff. I know that these movies are cut to death a lot, especially Weinstein. There's a reason why he had the name Harvey Scissorhands and everything. But like, I heard this about Color of Night recently.
I love that movie.
Oh, you do?
This is a movie with Javier Bardem and Johnny Depp.
That's Before Nightfall.
This is Bruce Willis' dog.
And a snake in the mailbox. This movie's awesome.
It's got Bruce Willis and Jane March, who was fresh off of a movie called The Lover.
The Lover.
And then she never made any movies ever again.
She was in a Tarzan. She was in a Tarzan movie with Casper Van
Dien. But I mean, for like that, for that 1 year when I was still getting Premiere Magazine, she was hot shit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Color of Night had a great fucking cast, though.
Yeah, it did.
Lance Henriksen, Chucky. What's his name?
Yeah.
He did the voice of Chucky.
His
name?
I know.
Brad Dourif.
Brad Dourif, yes, thank you.
Nice. Of all people to play
Leslie Ann Warren was in it, you know. Mm-hmm.
Scott Bakula.
Scott Bakula.
Yep.
the dude from Lord of Illusions.
I was just going to say fresh off Lord of Illusions.
Yeah.
like I
but anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt you. What were you saying about Color of Night?
Color of Night was it? It was on HBO or something going on. It was playing on HBO. And I flipped over there because Jane March is hot shit.
Mm-hmm.
And that
movie is raw in terms of
it's pretty raw, yeah. So I started reading trivia on this movie, and it said that the director had made one that everybody liked, but the producer was like, no, we got to cut it down. And so the one that we all saw was the inferior version, the one that you apparently like, though. No, it's got
there is a director's cut.
It's got a cult following. There's no doubt about that. But yeah. Apparently, director's cut. There's a director's cut that's amazing.
It's great.
And now maybe not. Oh, you've seen the director's cut.
You can buy it on Kino.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yes.
So that's why when you say Color of Night is one of your favorite movies. It's that one.
It's
that
one of my
version?
Favorite bad movies.
Okay, that version though, or well, is it the other one is okay too?
Well, the director's cut is only maybe 5 to 10 more minutes of sex.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Oh, okay. Well, then I need to watch this.
I gotta see
you
should
this.
Watch
Weirdly
it, yeah.
enough, that's what the Snyder cut is.
Oh yeah,
for Justice League.
Yeah,
just
5 to 10 more minutes.
They just say the phrase the
just,
Snyder cut
they
on
just
this show.
Insert Malin Ackerman in there for no reason to have a sex scene.
And have a Leonard Cohen's Hollywood.
Yeah. Okay, guys, it's time to talk about BetterHelp again.
BetterHelp.
Barrett is going to share his story.
Man,
with you.
You know how we're really big into mental health, you know, providing resources and pointing you to access and stuff like that. Been extremely impressed with this service. It's betterhelp.com. Got introduced to it, a few months ago or so. The last couple times we talked about this, I talked about my journey through it because I'm going through it. Mm-hmm. Never done therapy before. Find it incredibly useful. I'm already using the techniques that they've provided. Got a great therapist, excellent communication. But I want to talk about the service itself because this addresses every issue that I have about therapy because I love the idea of therapy. I'm lazy. It's hard to find who I would think would be a good one. How do you find a good therapist?
Mm.
Unless it's recommended directly to you.
Yeah.
And then, if you feel bad if you want to replace them or if you want to switch or something like that. There's just all kinds of things wrapped up in the process until you get to where Jeremy is, to where you've got a good therapeutic relationship and you're starting to make progress. This addresses all that because it not only matches you to a counselor or a therapist that suits your specific needs, whether it's depression or anger, or anxiety, PTSD, alcoholism, addiction, things like that. It matches you with that. It also matches you typically within your same state. So you got people that are familiar kind of with your surroundings and that kind of thing. And then if you don't have a good rapport or a good relationship, you try somebody else. They have over 3,000 licensed therapists on this service, which is insane to me.
That's awesome.
So it addresses everything that would preclude me from going to a therapist's office. I can log on, it's online, it's video chat, it's text, it's all that stuff. And it's really, really good, man. I can't recommend this service enough.
Now, I have talked a few times, a bunch on social media about mental health, my own journey with therapy, but medication, all of it. And, one of the things I hear a lot from people is that there aren't very many therapists near them. It's people who are from rural areas. And this is a service that can solve that problem.
Yep.
The other thing I hear a lot is I tried therapy. It didn't do much for me. And I would just say there are probably more mental health patients than not, who have to try a few therapists until they find the right relationship.
Absolutely. Typically same with medication.
Yeah. It is very
similar.
It's
not always 100% the first time.
I have been seeing the same therapist for almost 3 years now, almost 4 years. And I had done therapy in college and again a little bit after that, but I hadn't done therapy in about 10 years before I found this guy. Got super freaking lucky. Whereas a really good friend of mine went through 5 mm-hmm. before he found one that really worked. Thank God that he was persistent.
Yeah.
Because now he's seeing incredible change and progress. And so, if it doesn't click right away, there's 3,000 more of them on this service that you can go try.
Not to say that you should be burning through there. But I'm just saying that this service addresses those issues that everybody has. I mean, not
I don't know one single person that wakes up and says, I'm going to search through the entirety of the licensed therapists in my city and find exactly, you know, who's the top rated. This is a great service that does a lot of the work for you. You have to do your own therapeutic work, but all the other nonsense surrounding it, that is taken care of it for you. So go to, I just clicked on, so betterhelp.com/syncast. Remember that, not CinemaSins, /syncast. I just went to the URL. It could not be easier. You click on that, and it says get started. You sign up. They go through a few questions. They match you with somebody, and you see how it goes. It's amazing. And you get 10% off your first month. So it's a little bit cheaper. If you got any issues with finances or support or things like that, talk to them. Get started. Talk to them. You know, figure it out. Okay. Through that URL, you get 10% off your first month. Very much encourage you to do it. This is one of my favorite advertisements that we've done on Syncast because it means a lot to me and I think to us as a group.
Yeah, totally.
I guess we can get to sort of talking about individual movies.
Can I ask one specific question about, I don't know if this came up in celluloid closet, but you mentioned like the vilification, especially with like trans people. Where do we fall with Rocky Horror Picture Show? Because it's such an interesting dynamic to me. I actually love this movie. I know you're not a huge fan.
I like the music.
The music is infectious, mm-hmm. but I've
never
seen
it.
You've never seen it? Well, okay. No. I'll spoil it for you.
So I would watch Gone with the Wind before I would watch this. And no offense, it's like a streak.
You hate musicals.
Well, Rocky Horror Picture Show feels about as long as Gone with the Wind.
It does, late at night. But like Tim Curry's character is this audacious, this over the top transvestite from transsexual Transylvania, whatever. But it turns, so he's ostensibly the villain, but it turns a little bit on the head when he seduces both Susan Sarandon and then her husband.
Barry Bostwick.
Which it, you know, surprises him at first, but then he's just like, fuck it, man, I'm in. And like, he's got this relationship with Eddie, the Meatloaf character, and he's got this, the Meatloaf character.
Yeah, yeah.
And with Rocky himself. Where do we stand on this as being like a positive or a negative depiction in cinema?
Well, it was written by a gay man.
Mm. Yeah.
I think the play and the music was written by Richard O'Brien, who played Riff Raff. He wrote he wrote the whole thing. Nice. And it was a stage play in Britain before it was a movie. Mm. And ironically, they got most of the original cast to be in the movie. Tim Curry was the original Frankenfurter. Yeah.
Dude, this is a great Tim Curry performance.
I love it. I absolutely love it. I saw it when I was 16 years old at the Franklin Cinema at midnight and absolutely loved it. I have no problem with it. Now, that being said, if there are any trans people who do have a problem with it, specifically young trans people, our job is to listen to them and to take into consideration how they feel about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved it. I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
I read an article this morning about Euphoria. I know you said you haven't seen that yet.
I haven't seen it, no.
But it was talking to viewers that were trans, talking about how the show offered in Jules, a trans character that was the object of lust.
Oh, yeah.
Not lust necessarily, but desire. That this was a character
by everybody.
By everybody. and how rare that is them to see, you know, someone like them be the object of attention. I thought that was pretty fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, that show, I know we've talked about that show a lot, but the way that show not only deals progressively with current views on fluidity of sexuality and be whoever you are, date whoever you want to, that kind of thing, and juxtaposes that with the previous generation and their rigid-ass standards of, if this gets exposed, then I'm finished type of thing. And how that relates to each other, because they both interact. They both know what the impact is for each other. But the younger generation doesn't give a fuck amongst themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the older generation doesn't give a shit about the younger generation or like that. Or it doesn't give a shit about their how they're representing themselves.
There's even a scene. Have you seen the finale?
Yeah.
There's even a scene in the finale where a girl says to her boyfriend, it's okay if you're into guys. Mm-hmm. Sexuality is a spectrum.
Yeah.
No one is either all one way or the other. And she's not just saying it.
No.
Like, she believes it.
Yeah. She's like,
I was like, how often does a show come along that gives you characters like mm-hmm. that? Pretty rare.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. I will say the show Hung, which only had like a couple of seasons, had an episode where one of his clients was trans.
Uh-huh.
Although I don't think they go through with the whole, I don't think he has sex with her, though.
Huh.
I'm trying to remember if that happens or not. I think it's one of those things where it's like, well, let's put in a touching moment of some sort, but not go all the way because, you know, definitely Thomas Jane, he's all man. But they still, at the time, had some progressiveness in casting someone who was trans mm-hmm. in an actual trans part and everything, but not nearly as far as what Euphoria has done. Since we've talked in depth about the history and everything, I was going to start bringing up, we have brought up a bunch that are on this list,
mm-hmm.
but go through a few that we haven't talked about. We briefly mentioned Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. How many people have seen that movie?
It's been a long time since I've seen it.
Came out in 1994. It's an Australian film. Has Terrence Stamp, Hugo Weaving, and Guy Pearce in it.
Yeah, yeah.
God bless Terrence Stamp.
Oh, he's so good in this.
Well, he is and he isn't. He tries so hard to have a sense of rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
To try to... He's not the world's greatest drag queen, but he tries.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he's a damn good actor in it. And
he is.
And he does a great job.
This is 94?
94.
Yeah. So he's like 5 years away from the Limey, right? So he's
yeah.
Like,
yep.
But he's obviously but he's a very obviously different.
Well established by this
point. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
General Zod and drag.
I think they also there's the three different characters are they all have a different representation. Terrence Stamp is actually playing a trans woman.
Mm-hmm.
Guy Pearce is a gay man who does drag. But Hugo Weaving, there's a part in there where Guy Pearce is kidding him about being married because mm-hmm. he's actually married to a woman and
right.
everything.
And has a child.
And has a kid with him and everything. And he says, so what, you're straight? And he goes, no. And he goes, well, so you're gay then? And he's like, no. He said, what are you? And he goes, I don't have any fucking clue. And they just let it go.
And sometimes it's like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Leave him alone.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like...
awesome.
Yeah, I feel like in 1994, that type of thing, I was kind of like, my jaw dropped.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I'd never heard that before, you know, in a movie in the 90s. I felt like there was always a definition they had to find.
Right.
We didn't get into this whole fluid sexuality thing since the last 10 years,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
And so like the idea that he doesn't have any really idea, it's whatever, you know, was kind of a crazy revelation for a movie from 1994.
Kevin Smith tried to inject that in Chasing Amy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he did a great job.
No.
But, you know, they were trying to tackle that subject.
Cause even in Chasing Amy, they're trying to make it where she's either one thing or another, even though she might decide to switch or
she
whatever.
Likes the person and not the gender.
Right,
basically.
Right, yeah. They make it seem like in Chasing Amy that Ben Affleck is so awesome that he's converted her.
Exactly.
You know.
That fucking character
is
so great.
Holden McNeil.
Is that where they
I
had
think
the
his,
falling out, by the way?
His best pickup line is, you fucked up my cabbage patch.
Yeah.
Like, really?
Yeah, yeah.
And you're gonna that was what made you fall in love with them?
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean they worked again on Jersey Girl.
And oh, that's true.
Now Jersey Girl was when Ben Affleck started to become more famous than I mean he'd done Armageddon and all this, but
He's dating J-Lo at the time,
He was dating J-Lo at the time
she's
of Jersey
in the beginning
Girl,
of the movie.
And she's in it, she dies in childbirth. And
thanks for spoiling it.
Yeah, you know, for all you people who were just dying to watch Jersey Girl.
And I'll spoil the rest of it. He falls in love with Liv Tyler.
Yeah, he falls in love with Liv Tyler.
Again.
And he meets Bagger Vance at the end.
Yes, he does.
And
then he plays with the little animal cracker on his tummy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Yeah. I think we just set back.
Liv Tyler is in that movie, though, right?
What?
Liv Tyler is in that movie, right?
Yes.
Jersey Girl.
Yeah.
And then she's in Armageddon.
Yeah.
I'd never really made that connection.
But Will Smith does show up at the end of those movies.
I didn't realize that.
He's like going into some. I can't remember if he's like a writer or something, and he's going into some agency. And I think it's Will Smith, maybe even playing himself.
Might be.
And Will Smith gives him advice. That's why I said Bagger Vance. Yeah, there's some it's a surprise Will Smith at the end of the
surprise Will Smith.
Then there's The Birdcage, which is the remake of the La Cage aux Folles.
Which I've seen The Birdcage, but I've never seen the original.
Oh yeah. Mike Nichols directed this, I believe. Yeah.
Put Nathan Lane on the map.
Yeah, it sure did.
The movie's awesome.
It's really good. I haven't seen it in forever, though. But it's a farce. It's something that would fit in an episode of Frasier, right?
Absolutely.
It's a total farce, and it's just so funny how they play this balancing act all the way through.
It's funny that you say that, because the boss from Frasier, Kenny, is one of the reporters in The Birdcage.
Oh, really?
That's trying to catch a picture of the senator at the gay bar. Oh,
wow. And you have scene-stealing Hank Azaria in it. And,
this cast is ridiculous. Isn't it Gene Hackman in there?
Yeah, Gene Hackman's Calista in Flockhart. Calista Flockhart.
Diane Wiest.
Yeah.
Sheldon's mom. what's her name? The Robin Williams character's former wife. Doesn't she play like a Big Bang Theory character?
Yeah, it's not Allison Janney, and it's not.
She's in Bowfinger.
Is it Christine Baranski?
It's Christine Baranski.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
That's what's so funny about.
There's a tear of actresses.
That's what is so funny. That's what's so funny, though. If you say Allison Janney, I'm like, okay. If that's wrong, it's Christine Baranski. If it's not Debbie Mazar,
it's Sherilyn Fenn.
The other one I'm thinking of, it's Ileana Douglas.
Yes.
This one is perhaps, this is super controversial for a lot of reasons, but blue is the warmest color. I would like to actually know what your friend Tiffany thought of this movie.
I do not know. I have not discussed this with her.
Okay.
And I haven't seen it either. So.
Okay. Well, now I watched it and I liked it because I thought it was a really good depiction of a lesbian relationship. However, it's also like super porny and like the stories that came out of the movie's making are disturbing too.
They are. Yeah. And it's even knowing what I know about it, at least, which is certainly not what Lea Seydoux or Adele, what they know about it, it's like a little bit murkier than something like Last Tango in Paris, where we know definitively she wasn't informed about what they were doing. But like you said, and it is super porny, in where it's over the top, where guys like us are like, seriously, do we need like another 5 minutes of scissoring and shit
it's
like that?
Yeah, it's like, yeah, okay. Yeah. You go across the spectrum, right? You're like, oh, this is really hot. And then it's like, oh,
we're still
going.
But the relationship itself is played as just a very interesting, tumultuous at times, stable at times relationship that has a beginning, middle, and an end, and the two leads are fantastic together.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I enjoyed it as a movie. I know there's baggage that comes with it.
Let's talk about sex, Dave.
Okay.
Is there any movie that
Let's talk about you and me.
Yeah, there you go. I was hoping somebody.
I gotcha.
Are there any movies that really depict it correctly, or is it all like titillation?
Oh god.
I always hear after a movie that's like Blue is the Warmest Color comes out, like just numerous stories from lesbians who said, this is just not right. This is not how we do things. And
this is not how we do.
Right. And so I'm sitting there, I don't have any idea. So I'm like, well, then what is it then? Because I would like to know, you know, what's accurate then?
Well, Joey Lauren Adams told you.
Oh, yeah, Joey Lauren Adams.
Exactly. Our bodies are built to press a child.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but you have film. I mean, I think lesbian sex in film, so often was a softcore Playboy movie like The Hunger mm-hmm. with Catherine Deneuve and Susan Sarandon, where it was just, rose petals on breasts and, right, and soft lighting and white wine and tender kisses. But I am told by a lot of my lesbian friends that Desert Hearts, which came out a few years later, was probably the first true depiction of female homosexuality and sexuality within. Like I said, I've never seen Blue is the Warmest Color, mm-hmm. But there are other films. I think Bound was a good depiction, if mm-hmm. not still a little bit,
yeah,
Playboy.
Just a tad bit.
As an aside, my buddy Patrick was looking for that movie the other day, Bound,
uh-huh.
and found another movie called Bound.
I know what you're talking about.
It's a 50 Shades of Grey ripoff with Charisma Carpenter.
Yes, yes. Oh, my God.
What's that movie about?
And he watched it. Sounds pretty terrible.
It's, when I was doing research for this, it came up and I was like, oh, God, that's awful. I do think it's funny, though, that even in Booksmart, the Beanie Feldstein character is like, you can get it on. Get like your scissors on. And she's like that's not how it works.
That's not how it works. Yeah.
I mean, obviously, in mainstream films, they're very reticent to show actual gay men.
Yeah,
having sex.
Yeah. Well, it's like heterosexual men are more more comfortable looking at gay women than they are gay men having mm-hmm. sex.
Yeah,
and that's still to this day, it's like that. There are a few films I think that have gotten it right as far as male on male sexuality. I think European films do it better than films from our country.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen I Love You, Philip Morris with Jim Carrey?
Yeah.
There's a hilarious scene at the beginning of that where you think that he's having sex with his wife, and then all of a sudden it's revealed that he's gay. Mm-hmm. This guy's head comes up, and he's mm-hmm. like, do it, man. Come in my ass. So that was pretty realistic.
Yeah.
But
it can't be the cold open, but I want it to be the cold open.
I give you my permission.
That movie's great, by the way. I was working at Hollywood 27, and we got the critics screening of it. We didn't actually show the movie for the public, but we got the critics screening of it, and I got to see it through that. And, that movie's really good.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
Yeah.
But I think European films, especially, and this is something we haven't really talked about, European films were normalizing gay people went back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s,
mm-hmm.
especially in the Netherlands. Paul Verhoeven,
mm-hmm.
Like we mentioned before, Pedro Almodovar, and especially the British films back then.
Mm-hmm.
I think they got male-on-male sex right more than the U.S. has to this point, although there have been a few hot scenes here and there. We're just like, yeah, that's pretty sexy.
Yeah. Did you ever see Short Bus?
I did.
What do you think of that movie?
I liked it. I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. It was very raw, very honest.
Yeah.
I thought it was great.
Yeah. I don't know. I didn't like it when I saw it, and I don't know what it is. I think these movies that get advertised as we're actually fucking on screen and everything.
Right.
You know, that
people go to see it for that and not for an actual,
yeah. And I saw
story
this
or try to.
I'm pretty sure I saw this in the middle of three movies that day.
Yeah.
Because I was living in New York when this came out, and I went to the Sunshine Theater and saw. I was one of those days where I was like, I'm going to watch a movie here, and then I'm going to walk down to the street to that theater and watch that, and then I'm going to, watch another one afterwards. But that was sort of like in the middle of it, and I was like, what the hell, man? There's no real story. It doesn't
there
feel
is no
like
story, right?
Yeah, it's a provocative, we're actually having sex on film. Let's depict that. John Cameron Mitchell, who did Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
I love that movie.
That's a great movie.
Love
awesome.
That movie. Love the music. Love the whole story to that.
Yeah. Especially the title song. That song is awesome. 6 inches forward, 5 inches back.
I've got an angry inch.
Didn't mean to derail us with the sex talk.
It's all good.
I just thought that I hear that a lot when these type of movies come out,
mm-hmm.
and I'm like, okay, so then we need somebody who knows to make these movies then.
Yeah.
Because unless the only way we can ever show it is if it is super sexy and, like, you know, we want to get a rise out of the audience, so to speak.
I think, like I said before, French filmmakers, German filmmakers, anybody outside of the U.S. depicts gay sex better than our country does, and still to this day.
Have you ever seen Ali, Fear Eats the Soul?
No.
That's a Rainer Werner Fassbinder.
Oh, yeah.
Or Rainer Werner Fassbinder. Werner. Came out in the 70s, exactly what you're talking about. This is now there's also salacious stories behind the scenes on this movie, too. But that's another one. Actually, I'm trying to think if Ali Fear Eats the Soul had a gay. Because I'm getting the background of it. The Rainer Werner Fassbinder had a relationship with the guy who was in the movie.
Okay.
But it was some, like, awful thing. Hmm. Where, yeah, I don't want to get too
well,
much
the two
into
films
it.
That he has made that I've seen are one called Fox and His Friends and another one called Carell, with the dude who was in Midnight Express. I can't think of what his name was. And that was Warner's last movie, actually. Mm-hmm. And both of those have two very accurate depictions of gay sex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was something that came to my head, and I'm, you know, hopefully I didn't get, I mean, I know that Ali Fear Eats the Soul is mostly about, I think it's a man who falls in love with a much older woman. I think that's what the whole thing is. But the professor gave us all this backstory about what happened during the filming of it. And I think I'm maybe confusing a little bit of it. But we've talked a little bit about Booksmart. Then there's Boys Don't Cry. Another, that's a devastating one, too.
That's a heavy film.
Yeah.
Yeah. I heard an interview with Chloe Sevigny not too long ago where she was relaying very positive vibes from behind the scenes in that set, in the making of, but obviously the movie itself is hard to watch, man.
Then we talked a little bit about Bound, which, you know, isn't necessarily a gay film in any way, but
no, I mean, but it sets the plot going, right? Because it's Jennifer Tilly's with, it's not Chaz Palminteri, it's Joe Pantabatabati.
Oh, Joe, yeah.
Joey Pants.
Yeah.
And then it's Gina Gershon that piques her interest, right? Mm-hmm. And then it sets off. And so that's the inciting incident, I guess. But then it turns into this really cool noir mystery type of thing. This movie, I think, is underrated. I don't think people talk about it much anymore.
No.
I don't think they talk
about the other one with
Buffy. Chris McCarpenter.
Yeah.
What's crazy to me is if you watch something like Bound and then watch Speed Racer and try and comprehend that the same filmmakers made both of those films.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
right.
By the way, that piece of shit was trending on Twitter the other day as one of those, oh, this is way better than you remember. All that fucking Speed Racer.
To the level that it was trending on Twitter?
It was trending.
Yes.
And Emil Hirsch even came out and said, tweeted something to the effect. You probably love Speed Racer. We're trashing this movie.
Never seen it.
Okay.
Well, it is awful. Unless you want.
That's what I gleaned from the trailer.
Unless you want to be dizzied with, like people are, like, calling it this misunderstood masterpiece. No, it's loud.
It
and
is.
Too fucking bright and kinetic.
Yep.
And I loved the cartoon. Get off my back.
Yeah, and Bound is the complete opposite of that.
Yeah, it really is. I love Bound.
Big one, Brokeback Mountain on this list. We've recently talked a bunch about Brokeback Mountain. Do you consider this one like a big landmark film?
I do. Yeah. I do. I really do. It's like you said, it's a devastating film. It's a beautiful movie. Both Heath Ledger and Jake Gyllenhaal are crazy, insanely good in this movie. Mm-hmm. And even Michelle Williams and I think it's Linda Cardellini.
Anne Hathaway?
No, Anne
Hathaway. Linda Cardellini is in it.
She plays the sister, is that what we...
I don't remember what she plays.
Linda Cardellini's the girl that Heath Ledger dates after the divorce.
Yeah, that's right, at the end. Yeah. But yeah, Anne Hathaway. Everybody's amazing in it. This movie was robbed at the Oscars.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, it was.
Well, and it was funny because we've just talked about Boys Don't Cry and how Hilary Swank, when she won the Oscar, she comes up and says, "We've come a long way." And then I think, was it Boys Don't Cry was 2003, 2002? Can't remember what it was. We've come a long way. Brokeback Mountain comes out in 2005. And it's pretty clear that we haven't come that long of a way because everybody in the world said this movie was going to win.
Right.
No, but Crash wasn't even in the picture as far as, like, people predicting what was going to. Maybe it was 1 and 2. I don't remember if that was the case.
Was anybody nominated for actor or supporting? Did anybody win
for Brokeback?
For Brokeback, I can't even remember.
Heath Ledger was nominated,
but he didn't win.
He did not win.
Wasn't Michelle Williams nominated?
Michelle Williams was nominated too.
She didn't win.
She did not win.
Boys Don't Cry was 99.
Oh,
wow. Further back than that.
So yeah, so Hillary Swank says we've come a long way when she wins the Oscar, and then 5-6 years later, they don't give the Oscar to the clearly best film, and you know, Jack, I've talked about this before, watching that Oscar night, Jack Nicholson, even when he read Crash, he goes wow afterwards,
yeah,
because I don't think he was expecting it either. There was a lot of talk afterwards that there was such a huge cast in Crash that there were so many people who related to a lot of the actors who were in that movie that they just sort of naturally gravitated towards, you know, picking it when it came down to the winner and everything. But I don't know if that's the case or not. I think it was the fact that there was still a lot of old Hollywood that's voting, and
it has to be it.
And
I don't even think you can't put those two movies on the same level.
No, you really can't. But yeah, it got absolutely robbed, and especially now. I mean, that's why I wish there was a retro Oscars, and I'm sure that's been pitched before. But
yeah,
there should be a retro Oscars where you go back and say, yeah, definitely not Crash. Yeah, definitely not Green Book. You know, these type of movies.
Right, right.
Let's do it.
Yeah,
we should. Somebody decided one day to start the Razzies, and that's been a thing for 30 years. Why don't we start the
retro Oscars?
The retro Oscars. We'll just go 10 years back.
Yeah,
and we'll fix everything.
How serious are you about this?
Hearing you guys talk, I'm very serious about it.
Well, at the very least, it would make a great podcast topic.
Yeah,
would. We should totally do that.
Yeah.
We can write the rogues.
I will say this. I want to give credit where credit's due, because now I have heard this before. I've heard retro Oscars before. This is not an idea that's originating
here. Yeah.
And also, I think somebody on Facebook asked me, I think it was on the All That Film podcast, was asking me about changing certain Oscar things. So I do want to give that credit. I'm just saying that it's an idea that should be done, and it would be fun to do. Obviously, I don't want to say that. I don't want to pretend like that came to of nowhere or anything like
not
that.
Not to get off track too far, and I know we've said something like this before, but Ang Lee is just a really fascinating filmmaker in terms of how many different types of projects. And now with the halftime, Billy's halftime waltz or whatever it was.
And now
the Gemini Man
remembering shit during the waltz.
And now with the Gemini Man, he seems to be a little bit intrigued by new technologies. But you know, Hulk and the Ice Storm and Sense and Sensibility, and he's right up there.
This is his best movie though, right?
Brokeback?
Yeah.
So far, yeah, I would say so. The Ice Storm is fucking awesome.
Ice Storm is
a great movie.
Yeah, and I really like Sense and Sensibility a lot.
Yeah,
are the top three.
Yeah.
Yeah, although we could probably definitely go through his filmography and find others that would get close to that.
Yeah. Well, he made Crouching Tiger, didn't he?
Made Crouching Tiger, and I believe the movie that was it Joyluck Club?
Was
that the movie that got him on the map?
So yeah, he's had a pretty good run, man.
Yeah, but I just like his diversity.
I do too.
It's like that guy, his name, Danny Boyle. He's got a very similar diversity. Always looking for some kind of new thing. I like that.
By the way, while he's looking this up, I rewatched Sunshine again, Danny Boyle thing.
Yeah.
I'm convinced this guy can't stick the landing. Like, that ending is hot garbage, too.
Yeah.
No pun intended, but, like, 20 Days Later, The Beach, and Sunshine, even Trainspotting to a certain extent, like, his endings aren't
Slumdog.
Good. Slumdog. Fuck that.
Wayne Wang directed Joy Luck Club. The one that I'm thinking of is Eat, Drink, Man, Woman.
Oh, okay.
So, let's see. Let's some more list go back to the list here. Here's a movie I've never seen, But I'm a Cheerleader.
Oh, I saw that.
It's another gay conversion.
Natasha
story.
Lyonne.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I haven't seen it but the one time.
Gay conversion comedy.
Oh yeah.
It's Clea Duvall, right?
Clea Duvall.
Yeah, yeah. It's a good movie.
Good cast. Melanie Lynskey from Heavenly Creatures is also in that one. Yep. I'm hard pressed to think of what the main actresses who actually runs the conversion camp. I can never think of her name.
So Michelle Williams is in that too.
Oh, that's right. She plays the best friend.
Mm-hmm.
Was
it Kathy Moriarty?
Kathy Moriarty. She does a great job. RuPaul is in that movie.
Yeah. He's the converted back guy, right?
Yeah. He's actually the second in command, I think, at the camp. No, great movie. Funny movie.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to see that. I remember when it came out and it had gotten some raves. I just never got a chance to see it. It's really funny. Here's a movie that we've discussed a bunch in this room, but I would like to hear your take. Call Me By Your Name.
Great movie.
Mm-hmm. Are you in any way disturbed that the kid is 17 in the movie?
No, because I was a lot younger.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, when I came into my sexuality. So, no, I wasn't disturbed by that at all.
Mm-hmm. It's also a cultural thing, too. I think we've discussed this. In Europe, I think the age of consent is a little bit younger. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of someone being underage is, like, not a big deal. Here it is a huge big deal, but...
Let me ask you something about this movie. So my big beef with this, this movie's a little bit icky to me.
Okay. The peach.
No, it's around the peach. It's literally around the peach because to me, this kid, it matters less to me that he's 17 or whatever the number is the fact that he seems to me confused.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that in a pejorative way. He starts off by, early in the movie, he sleeps with a girl.
Mm-hmm.
Then he forms this relationship with Armie Hammer's character. And then around that peach scene, he breaks down. Like, he doesn't know. He's fucking fruit right now. Like, he doesn't know what his sexuality is. And the fact that Armie Hammer's character is so much more experienced and so much older and so much, you know... wiser, seems like it's taking advantage of this character to an uncomfortable degree for me. And it's less that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. I think that's more Armie Hammer's character than it is Timothée Chalamet's character.
Oh, I totally agree. I'm saying that his character,
because
I'm not going to say predatory or anything like that, but he's certainly taking full advantage of this, what I think is a bit of confusion, at least at this point in his life.
Right. And I think that's with anything, gay, straight,
yeah.
Bi. I mean,
feel the exact
puberty
same
is confusing. Mm-hmm. Coming into your own sexuality is confusing. But yeah, I agree with you.
Mm.
Well, his dad doesn't seem to have a problem with it.
Mm.
No, his dad is completely okay with it. I think I asked that question the wrong way at the top. I'm not talking about when he's deciding to go through all of his, you know, to explore his sexuality. I'm more about the Armie Hammer relationship with a 17-year-old the thing that I was trying to get at. But yeah, again, it's a European thing is a little bit different than from here. So
by the end of the movie, you know, when they're having that last phone conversation, it's been, I think, about a year since they've seen each other. And, Timothy's character, Elio, is still very much obsessed with this relationship, but you can tell by the end of the phone call that Armie's character has moved on. He's getting ready to get married.
Mm-hmm.
And it was never serious for him to begin with because ultimately he's a coward. Armie's character is a coward.
Mm.
You know, they've been That's murmurs good, they yeah. might make a sequel to this.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And I'd be curious because I kind of interpreted it that way too, and I don't know how you come back around to put these two people back in each other's lives in a way where...
Well, I can't remember what the director's name is.
Luca Guadagnino.
Yeah, something like that.
That's what point with
yes,
my pronunciation.
That's what it is.
I think he had said with the sequel, he didn't think that they would come back together in the sequel.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. He thinks that even Timothy's character would be heterosexual.
So you think a potential sequel would just tell two parallel stories?
I have no idea.
That's interesting. That's interesting. When I heard that they were talking about a sequel to that, it blew my mind.
Yeah, yeah.
I think if it does, it would be a cheat, you know?
Yeah. No, you want that, because I agree, this is a very well-made movie, and it's beautiful and everything, and that last shot is just arresting of him just crying, because that signifies the end of this whole story. Totally. He's coming to terms throughout the entirety of the credits of the end of this torrid affair that took place over this summer.
The first time he's ever felt love. I mean, you don't even get that with the girlfriend he's with at the beginning of the movie. He doesn't love her.
No.
But he did love Army's character.
Yep.
It's the first time he's ever been extremely heartbroken. Mm. I equate this film to almost the gay version of... did you ever see Summer Lovers? It was an 80s film with Daryl Hannah and Peter Gallagher.
Yeah, I never saw that.
It was a French film. Mm. I think it was a French film. But it was a moment in time, like just a one summer where you go through this one experience and it never came before. You'll never have it again.
Peter Gallagher and Daryl Hannah?
Peter Gallagher, Daryl Hannah.
That's a lot of good eyebrows.
Yeah, it is a lot of good eyebrows.
Wow.
But I thought it was a fantastic movie. But again, like that movie and Brokeback Mountain and these important Oscar-nominated gay films, again, we come back to the fact that, oh, it's a sad, depressing ending. You know, I'm really looking forward to a time where we can... where there will be Oscar-worthy gay and lesbian films that end in happiness. Not so depressing, you know.
No,
that there's a hopefulness at the end.
Right, which brings up Dallas Buyers Club.
Oh God. No.
Speaking of which,
yeah. You're absolutely right. I mean, there's a lot of these. I'm trying to think if I can think of one that really ended on. Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert kind of has an uplifting ending. And
there are many that have uplifting endings.
Yeah,
you know?
But it's not the norm.
Love, Simon.
Okay. Yeah.
All these movies that are coming out now. It seems to be headed that way.
Yeah. How does the Kids Are All Right end? Don't they end up?
It's an adorable ending.
It's a happy ending, right?
Yes, yeah. It is. It's very contentious up until then.
Yeah,
but no, it's almost like it's not.
Yeah,
but it's almost like a sitcom freeze frame moment where everybody's like,
"Yeah, okay, all right." I felt like I remembered that one wasn't.
But, although that one is, I mean, it's depicting a lesbian relationship, but it's, I don't think it's really about that.
No,
necessarily.
Right.
Like, it's not about what's going to happen to their relationship, really.
It is in the middle because one of them sleeps with him.
Yeah. But I mean, it's not because they're gay or
No. I think it's that they, through that affair, they rekindled their love for each other. And I think it's been a while since I've saw it, but I think they have like this, not an embrace, but like they hold each other's hand and that kind of thing. And you can tell that they're starting to rekindle that romance as a function of her dalliance with Hulk.
Yeah. right. It's amazing how the effects in that are so much. They're so much better later on. I mean, it's so terrible in that
Hulk
one.
Is hooking up with Mar-Vell.
Yeah. It's so weird.
Isn't Julianne Moore somewhere in the MCU?
I'm sure she is.
Not yet.
Yeah.
Eventually, everyone will be.
Well, they made that joke in was it Infinity War where they were talking about Kevin Bacon and is he a part of the Avengers? And Thor's like, he might be. There've been a few additions to the team and maybe so Dallas Buyers Club, that's the biopic essentially, I guess. Would you call that a biopic, really? I think sometimes it's a fictionalization of something that happened is not necessarily
based
on a true story. What is it, Ron Woodruff is his name,
sounds right,
something like that. Matthew McConaughey plays. And that was another movie that came out and everybody, it seemed like this is not what happened. This is not what he was about and so on and so forth. And
right.
You don't know what to believe about these things anymore. How do we watch biopics anymore? Every time there's something about something real, somebody's got to come out and say, well, it didn't really happen this way. I know that you love this part, but, that didn't happen. Yeah,
It's like with that biopic Ray, and afterwards everybody's like, well, he wasn't blind.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I know.
Elton was gay?
Yeah. What? How'd that happen? What'd you think of Bohemian Rhapsody, by the way?
I liked Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah.
I liked it a lot. thought it was great. I thought originally they were going to skirt the issue of his sexuality and just say he was bisexual, which he was not. I like the fact that Lucy Boynton is his girlfriend in that movie. I like the fact that her character, I can't remember what her name was, basically tells him, no, honey, you're gay, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bohemian Rhapsody floored me. I didn't like the movie at all, but it floored me that people I know who are, I consider, like, Republicans and conservative and everything liked that
movie.
Yeah,
they liked it. Well, they just like Queen.
Yeah, maybe
they love
so.
Queen.
But
yeah, they're stomping along at Titans games.
Yeah,
to
yeah,
rock.
That's true. That's true. It, maybe it's just the songs, but I know for a fact that movie, if it had come out 15 years before, they would not have been down with any of the gay content. That
they wouldn't have addressed it at all.
Yeah. Dog Day Afternoon, which is a direct plot point of the whole movie. Al Pacino is trying to rob a bank in order to get his
sex change operation.
Boyfriend a sex change operation. Chris Sarandon. Yeah.
Oh, I just showed this film to my parents.
The movie's fucking awesome.
Yeah, Dog Day Afternoon is awesome.
I just showed this film to my parents a couple of weeks ago. They had never seen it before. So we got to watch this movie. They loved it.
Oh, snaps. It's so good.
Yeah, that was one of those movies I watched. First time I watched it, I was like, I hate this movie. It's terrible.
Oh, yeah.
And then I watched it again. I was like, what was I thinking?
It happens all the time.
The Favorite.
This is now on HBO.
It is.
And I've watched snippets of it. I've been waiting because I want to show it to my wife to watch the whole thing. Now, fuck you. Fuck off. This movie's fucking awesome.
But you haven't seen it.
Oh, this movie's weird.
But you haven't seen
it. No. I saw it in theaters.
Oh, you're
just
waiting to watch it.
Waiting to watch it again.
Okay.
Yes,
oh,
it's borderline absurd. But I love it.
I Yorgos Lanthimos is like right in my wheelhouse.
Because
I love The Lobster. Never saw Killing of the Sacred Deer.
Yeah, I haven't seen it either.
But this is just. And when I watched the thing and the anachronistic dancing, it's fucking awesome.
Oh my God.
I like it when she sticks her tongue in my what?
Yeah,
what
I don't
does
know.
She say?
That's one of the weirdest final shots of any movie ever.
It's fantastic.
It's a metaphor.
Yes.
Well, okay.
This is
I think.
This is like
that's what I gleaned from it.
Competitive lesbianism.
Yeah, it is.
Well, it's okay, it is, but
okay.
The two characters, Rachel Weisz and Emma Stone, may not be.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
Is they're in pursuit of social
power.
Standing, power.
It's power.
And the queen is
lesbian, or is open to it
What's crazy is that I don't think there's any sex in the movie. There's a little bit of kissing with Rachel Weisz and Olivia Colman in the library when she finds out, but there's no like overt sex. It's just like little pithy things like I like it when she sticks her tongue inside of me.
And Nicholas Holt is awesome in this movie.
He is.
And
so
I obviously didn't like this movie as much as you did, but that was revolution for me. Revolution?
Yeah.
This was revelatory for me to see, because I had mostly associated him with like Beast from the X-Men movies.
Mm-hmm.
But here he's just like, he's got range.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gods and Monsters, which is the James Whale biopic. Ian McKellen playing James Whale. This movie's really good.
Brendan Fraser?
Yeah, Brendan Fraser.
Oh, yeah, this movie's great.
Brendan Fraser. I guess James Whale inserted a lot of gay subtext into Frankenstein movies. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. Is it just the Outcast part of it?
I think it's just the Outcast, yeah.
Mm-hmm. They in Celluloid Closet, they talk about the whole idea of gay characters having to die by the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a Tennessee Williams movie that they
Suddenly Last Summer.
That's it. And it's got Elizabeth Taylor, and this is right after Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Right.
Which is another one where they cut out all the gay
subtext
that was in it. Yeah.
Oh, there was quite a bit in there, right?
Yeah. Was it called Suddenly Last Summer, the gay character isn't even seen.
They don't even show his face.
Right. And it's all talked in flashback and everything. Mm-hmm. And by the end of it, this guy is getting torn apart by savages, essentially. And they said, well, this reminds me of, I think it's it's Frankenstein, where they show, you know, all the villagers coming out, and they sort of like show them side. I don't know if they show side by side, but they do at least juxtapose those two movies, how they're chasing him up the hill and they've got the torches and everything. And the same thing's happening to this faceless person
in
this other movie.
It wasn't good enough to get a face.
But I can't remember I can't remember the plot of Gods and Monsters. I know that Brendan Fraser is like, is he hired as like a?
He's a gardener. I think it's been a while since I've seen it too. He's hired as a gardener. James Whale is in failing health. I think he's losing a bit of his memory.
He can't draw anymore.
And
that's what he's. He starts off as like his staff member, and then like he sits with them basically, and he relays all these stories. Mm-hmm. And Ian McKellen is horny as hell in this movie. He's constantly trying to get this dude naked, and like trying to fuck with him and all that stuff.
It's fun.
But didn't he win the Oscar this year? For this one,
I think he got nominated. I don't think he won it though.
He's so good.
It won something at the Academy Awards. I can't remember what it was.
It won screenplay.
Adapted
screenplay. It won. Let's see. So Bill Condon won for screenplay, and it was McKellen was nominated, and Lynn Redgrave was nominated.
That's right.
Oh wow.
But yeah, this is a really good movie. I just haven't seen it in forever.
Yeah, it's good.
Heavenly Creatures, Peter Jackson's normal film from the 90s.
Yeah, and this is a great movie I haven't seen forever, but it's so fucking great. Melanie Lynskey again, Kate Winslet. It's in, this is a true story, right?
Oh, yeah. This is in my top five films of all time.
Yeah, so good. Yeah.
It's a great film. Based on a true story, two girls in Christchurch, New Zealand, completely obsessed with each other, create this fantasy world. Their parents think their relationship is unhealthy. They think that they're gay. They conspire to separate them. And basically, these two girls kill the mother of one of the girls.
Mm-hmm.
And credits roll.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. They're so good. And Kate Winslet, I mean,
that was her first movie.
That was her first movie, yeah. And
that was Melanie's first movie too.
Yeah. I heard Melanie Lynskey, I think it was a Marc Maron podcast, talk about how she got cast for that movie, and it's some unusual circumstance too. I can't remember what it was. It may not have been that unusual. It may have just been like an open casting call in New Zealand and she just happened to win it, but I seem to think that there was some sort of story behind her getting cast in that.
I wonder. It's weird because she seems, I guess the roles that I identify her with are so American.
Yeah,
she's New Zealand as fuck.
Oh yeah, yeah. Her accent is so thick.
And like there was an episode with Marc Maron actually of Easy, that show on Netflix,
right?
Where he's a professor and she's one of his students, and she has her normal accent. I'm like, what the fuck is she doing?
Oh yeah, yeah. She. And I think she uses the same American accent and everything. So it sounds like she's just constantly just sounds like that, right?
Yeah. This is the gal that's in Shattered Glass.
No.
Yeah, she's in it. She's in it.
She was on Charlie Sheen.
Oh, Shattered
Show.
Glass. Yeah. I don't. What Charlie Sheen show? Anger Management?
No, the one with
Two
and a Half Men. I think she was a recurring character on that show.
Yeah, I never watched that show, so I didn't.
Maybe I'll just not say things out loud.
The fact that you're bringing it up makes me believe that she's totally in that show.
I'm gonna look it up,
but I never watched it. I love Melanie Lynskey so much, and when you brought up the movie,
I don't feel at home.
I watched it that night.
Did you like it?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Isn't that a great movie?
I've seen that movie so many times.
Really?
Yeah. It's why I keep my Netflix account.
It's so bonkers.
It's so good. She's me in this movie.
The
invisible, forgotten.
She's a lot of us.
You don't have to be an asshole.
She's a lot of us.
People
motherfuckers. Yeah, they're assholes and dildos.
It's so violent, but it's so funny. The violence is so funny. When the guy's hand gets blown off and she just automatically pukes.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's the guy looks at her and he's like,
stop that.
Yeah. But yeah, she says, everybody's assholes and dildos and fuck faces.
Yeah. Her sister's like, no. Well,
it's
no.
funny. You just watch. Yeah, you just watch what her life from the beginning until she says that. You'd be hard pressed to disagree.
Yeah,
that's right.
Because everybody she runs into are these people, are these dildos.
She was on Two and a Half Men and was in Shattered Glass. When you I was thinking about the right person.
No, Shattered Glass I knew, but Two and a Half Men, that's you're barking up the wrong tree on that one. But she's in a ton of stuff, and as soon as I heard she was in that, I was like, all right, go watch that tonight. Yeah,
I'd like to also state for the record, I didn't regularly watch Two and a Half Men. I just, it's reruns, you flipped stations, you see faces.
Okay, now that you've been brave enough to admit it, no, I've never seen it.
It's also in weird places like IFC and shit
like
that.
Yeah, I just don't want people coming away from this podcast thinking I watch that show regularly. Or Big Bang Theory. Neither one did I watch with any regularity ever.
We talked a little bit about Hedwig and the Angry Inch. The only thing about I thought this movie was a lot older for some reason.
Hedwig?
It's 2001.
Yeah.
And I thought it was like 97 or 98, but I might have been thinking about Velvet Goldmine because that was another one that had come out around that time. But
based off of Bowie and Iggy Pop, in that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then there is High Art. I never saw this. Ally Sheedy, Radha Mitchell.
Yeah, this is it's not necessarily, it's on the artsy side of porny. Have you seen this?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. Like it's
I enjoyed it.
I did too.
It's depressing as fuck, but I enjoyed it.
It is. It is. The performances are good. This is an early Radha Mitchell performance too.
Patricia Clarkson as the heroin junkie girlfriend of Ally Sheedy is amazing in this movie.
Oh yeah.
And this is before, you know, 6 Feet Under, before really anything that she'd
Yeah, no, this is a, it's a good, fancy.
Fancy.
The title implies like it's beautiful to look at. And good performances. This is a recommend for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Hours, which is the Virginia Woolf. It's three different eras.
Three stories, yeah.
Or is it three stories in one era, or is it three different eras?
I don't remember.
It's three different eras. Yeah. It's Virginia Woolf writing the book, whatever her magnum opus was.
Yeah.
Somebody in the 50s or so reacting to it, and then somebody in the early 2000s.
Yeah, Meryl Streep and Julianne Moore.
Julianne Moore's in the 50s.
Yeah. Desperate housewife.
Is she like a housewife? Yeah, who's just completely discontent with her life.
Mm.
Julianne Moore is in a lot of these type of movies. Mm. She works with this one guy who loves Douglas Sirk a lot, and I'm trying to remember the name. And that guy who likes Douglas Sirk a lot makes movies like Douglas Sirk used to make, these real over melodramatic stuff like. And I'm trying to remember. I remember heard this guy's name.
Is it Todd Haynes?
It might be Todd Haynes.
Okay.
Todd Haynes did what's that?
He did Safe, I think.
Far From Heaven was the movie that I'm thinking of that she's in. But she's in a lot of these super heavy melodramatic movies. I mean, obviously Julianne Moore's in everything. Can do everything. But there's a certain amount of movies that she's in that has this kind of like that. The Douglas Sirk influence. Douglas Sirk did a movie called Written on the Wind, and I saw this movie in college, and the professor was like, "Now I want you to take note of the amount of leaves coming in into the parlor when they open up the door or whatever." And in the very beginning of this, it's like a drunk Robert Stack driving down the road with some woman or whatever, and I think they crashes the car at this mansion. They open the door, and yeah, sure enough, it's like all these leaves are just blowing in, and just like just a crazy amount of them and everything. And everybody just starts laughing because we were told. But yeah, The Hours. Julianne Moore who has the relationship in it, or does everybody?
There's this. Do you remember this? There's like some subtext running through all three of the storylines where Virginia Woolf has this odd relationship with this affection with her sister.
Mm-hmm.
That's you know, unusual. And Julianne Moore, I think, is attracted to another woman in her relationship. Mm-hmm. And then there's something with the Meryl Streep character. I forget what.
Yeah.
Julianne Moore abandons her husband and kid, and the kid later is played by Oh God,
Melanie Lynskey.
No, not Melanie Lynskey.
Find a way.
Ed Harris. Ed Harris is dying of some incurable disease or something, and spoiler alert, ends up throwing himself out the window.
Mm.
And that's the Meryl Streep.
Subplot
of everything.
I don't like this many movie, people. By the way. So many people in this.
This
Claire
movie.
Danes, Jeff Daniels, Allison Janney, who's not Christine Bransky, Margot Martindale, Toni Collette, John C. Reilly. But yeah, there's a lot of people.
Mm.
Miranda Richardson. All right, so I'm going to have to maybe possibly start running through some
of these. Let's run it down, baby.
Now, that doesn't mean we maybe should just do this again at some point. So
I'm having a lot of fun.
Yeah, I am too.
Dave, are you having fun?
I'm having fun. Sweet. I think you guys should do it again. I think you should also, if you do it again, invite lesbian commentators, people of color,
definitely want to do that.
Transgender people to, because I am only one small.
Oh, for sure.
Opinion.
We're,
no,
yeah,
you speak for the entire LGBT community, no. Right?
Yes. I don't want to give that impression that, you know, that you're here to give us the opinion that's written in
well,
stone.
Well, that's what it feels like. God damn.
All right.
It.
Well, no. We just failed completely.
No. This
we
was
failed.
Awesome.
I'm going to run some of these down. If we want to talk about them in detail, we can. I know there's a few on here that are definitely, but some of them are like, yeah, okay, it's got some themes, but it's not a big deal. Howl, I never saw the movie. James Franco's in it. I've read the Allen Ginsberg.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know how they make a movie out of that.
It's not very good.
Yeah.
Have you seen this?
Nope. Read the book. Never saw the movie.
Yeah. I mean, Ginsberg had this long time relationship with, it's not his agent or his manager, but it was somebody closely associated with him in his career.
Mm-hmm.
And that's explored. And this seemed like a James Franco, I'm in the height of doing my passion projects, you know.
I mean, I think he's drawn to shit that is hard to make.
Yeah.
They did another movie like that called Kill Your Darlings about Ginsberg with Harry Potter. What's his name?
Daniel Radcliffe.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah.
We've talked a little bit about I Love You, Philip Morris. Then, a movie in the 90s that was, it's very dated now, but In and Out came out. It was a mainstream film from Paramount. Yeah. What do we think about In and Out today?
You know, I haven't seen it since the theater. Mm-hmm. I liked it then. It was a movie based off of Tom Hanks's acceptance speech for Philadelphia.
Yes.
And then I thought that was genius just to create a movie out of that.
Well, and it's funny. I think everybody had that moment when Tom Hanks was accepting his Oscar and just said, oh, yeah, this is dedicated to my professor who was also gay and named him by name.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of us were sitting there going, whoa, wait a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
Hopefully his professor is out and he didn't just out his
exactly.
drama professor.
And, so they make this whole movie and Matt Dillon plays Tom Hanks in this or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But I thought this movie was really funny. It's just that, I don't know, the ending is one of those I Am Spartacus type endings I don't get on board
like
with.
I'm gay, like
everybody who has for the whole movie been homophobic
and all of a sudden gay in solidarity,
the exactly. whole town turns around pretty quick
because they love this guy.
I will say the Wilford Brimley one is funny. I'm the man's father and I'm gay.
This movie is complicated. I think I loved it. I probably haven't seen it in 5 or 6 years. It's got a lot of great jokes.
Yeah,
because Kevin Kline is really funny.
Yeah,
but there's the subplot with Matt Dillon's model girlfriend.
Yeah,
where they make some lazy jokes about like eating disorders and
whatnot. Oh, yeah. There's like a casual, like, I've got to go vomit or something like that.
Yeah. And so maybe the movie hasn't aged as well as I want to think.
I mean, I can think of a couple of scenes right now that in and Out that you wouldn't probably put in a movie today. But
Joan Cusack is brilliant in this movie.
Yes.
She's brilliant in everything.
That's true.
Joan Cusack
is super
underrated.
Didn't she get nominated for that movie?
I think she did. She is,
and then
super...
she won, and she outed her former teacher as gay.
That's why it's so ironic.
And that was the basis
was
for the movie. No, I'm just
In fact, didn't it get? Was that the only nomination? Yeah, Joan Cusack was the only nomination for that movie. A movie I remember coming out And everybody, it was a big furor because Patrick Stewart was in it. Jeffrey, 1995.
That was the first film he did right after Star Trek The Next Generation went off the air.
And
he wanted to do something different, really completely different than Jean-Luc Picard.
As recently as a few years ago, somebody was like talking about how look at Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart both out and proud, and Patrick Stewart came back on Twitter and was like, I'm not gay. And it's this movie that has persisted that misconception in people's minds.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was talked about a lot. I mean, it was a big, big deal.
Oh, I remember people telling me, like it was fact, that David Geffen and Keanu Reeves got married.
Yeah, I remember that.
And,
what?
Yeah, and I was like, I asked them very sincerely. I was like, do you not think that two people of that caliber got married, they would be able to keep that a secret?
Wow. I don't think I'd ever heard that one. That's crazy.
Oh, my God. That was a thing.
Urban
of course,
legend back in the 90s.
Oh, right? Yeah. And of course, that's been exacerbated since the internet became more used and everything. But yeah, I mean, everybody who ever did any, Tom Hanks obviously had the rumors because of just doing Philadelphia, even though it was clear he was married and had kids. And anyway, Jeffrey, was that a good movie?
I enjoyed it at the time. I haven't seen it probably since it came out. Mm-hmm. Good performances, good cast.
Stephen Weber.
If memory serves, yeah. Patrick Stewart's like a bit character. He's a supporting character.
He's like the best friend of Stephen Weber.
Yeah.
Like the older gay male that you go to advice for.
Yeah.
Stephen Weber's character is completely scared by the AIDS epidemic. Yeah. He swears off sex, he goes celibate, and as soon as he does that, he meets like the guy of his dreams, who of course has HIV.
Yeah.
And so he spends the entire movie debating on what to do.
Yeah. So. Skipping over a couple to Milk, the biopic essentially of the San Francisco mayor. Sean Penn plays Harvey Milk. Although, and this was the first time I remember something like this happening, but that's probably my narrow worldview. Dustin Lance Black, who is gay, and Gus Van Sant, who is gay, were the creators of this movie, which is something that I don't think I had ever really seen before, although it's probably happened a million times, but that seemed to be a big deal back in 2008. Milk, I think Sean Penn is awesome in it, very deserving of the Oscar and everything. I don't know if I like the movie too much, though.
Well, no, I didn't.
It's a very slow film.
Is it Brolin that plays his?
Brolin.
Brolin's in it.
He's the
rival candidate.
Yeah, he's the guy who ends up killing
him, right? Yeah.
Sean Penn does a great job. I do not believe that he could attract James Franco or Diego Luna.
well, it's like the movie Chef, where Jon Favreau. Sofia Vergara and Scarlett Johansson.
Right.
Does he sleep with Scarlett in that movie?
That's post-coital, is that pasta.
Okay. Post-coital pasta?
Post-coital pasta. I've made it many times.
So have I.
Please elaborate.
That's a good band name.
Speaking of post-coital pasta. No. Now, no matter what I say, it doesn't matter. No, Monster is Charlize Theron. I swear to God, I heard it pronounced Charlize, and this is why I say that all the time.
Hey, you have that. I have Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah, I don't know where you heard that, but
you were right. It's hockey players.
Yeah, but
I got Mia Jojovic. So,
that's true. I think. I blame
Joan Rivers for that one. That's
I actually heard that, and I used to say that all
Mia
the time.
Jojovic,
Charlize Theron and Christina Ricci. Obviously, the movie's more about what was
Eileen Wuornos,
yes. I would say that it was more about that than really the lesbian relationship.
It's interesting because I liked this movie. I haven't gone back and watched it, but the movie is presented to where Christina Ricci's character is the whole motivation of this murder spree, because she wants to take care of her, and she's not able to get any like real work.
Yeah.
She's presented as a very sympathetic character. Rightfully so, because she's had a history of trauma and all that stuff, but not a
it's one of those movies that we were talking about last week where, like, I thought it was very good, but I don't need to watch it again.
Yeah. No, another movie that also has, I think, a documentary, too, that if you want to watch that instead. I don't know what the documentary was called, but it's another one of those where you kind of have an option.
Mm-hmm.
Moonlight, Best Picture from 2016.
Hey, I just watched this.
Yeah?
This movie's fucking awesome.
Yeah,
it's
really good.
It's depressing as balls.
Yes, it is.
Again, really that's why it was nominated for an Oscar.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
And one controversial.
I really liked Moonlight. I didn't think it was Best Picture. I still think La La Land's Best Picture that year. But,
I agree.
But Moonlight is really, really good. And talk about... You know, I mean, I don't know if this was ever mainstream. I don't know if you could just go to your multiplex and watch this. Do you remember if you could?
I think it was just, that's where I saw
it. Or Green Hills, wherever it was.
Yeah.
Finally, maybe, possibly, we had come a long way, as Hilary Swank said in 2000, and then we skipped over Brokeback Mountain, mm-hmm. and then finally awarded this movie. Moonlight is really good. Really beautiful movie. Highly recommend that one. Mulholland Drive has a lesbian scene in it. You know, that's
sure
does. it's probably the thing that you can't like think about this movie without thinking of it.
Well, the note in there is that literally,
yeah, if you're straight guy.
The only thing that I know actually happened in the movie that wasn't a dream was that they had sex.
Yeah. But Mulholland Drive is an excellent film.
We love David Lynch.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about My Own Private Idaho, The Perfection. Mm-hmm. I've heard of this.
This is the Netflix Allison Williams and
Stephen
Weber.
Oh, wow.
No,
cellists.
I've done more than heard of this. I've seen this.
It's such an innocuous title.
Well, that's the thing. It's so innocuous that I was like, okay, yeah, I don't know. Maybe.
Also, Perfection is the name of the town in the Tremors movies.
Oh, yeah.
Just FYI. I don't know why I know that.
Have you seen this, Dave?
Shout out to Michael Gross.
Yeah.
No, I'm so not a TV person. I've like have a backlog of things. I just started watching The Handmaid's Tale last night. That's how far back I am.
Well, this is a movie.
TV.
Yeah, it's a movie. It's on Netflix, but it's a movie.
Yeah. Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's bonkers.
It's fucked up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it as much as you can enjoy a movie like this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Philadelphia. Is one of my favorites on this list.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Tom Hanks thing when he's going through when he's listening to the Maria Callas at the end, and that's always been very moving to me. And the courtroom drama is very compelling and everything. I just love everything about it. And you know, and the Denzel Washington character, it could have been easy to just make him, oh yeah, I'm totally sympathetic to the cause and everything, but he's not. He's not mm-hmm. sympathetic, no. And it takes a party for him to finally go, mm-hmm. okay, I see you more as human now.
It's only when he's dying that he actually touches his face. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And he's about to.
Yeah, that and I never thought of it that way too. That's a beautiful observation.
Mm.
I never thought about the touching part of it. But like, yeah, I mean,
he shakes his hand at the beginning of the movie, and then he says, "I have AIDS," and then he kind of like, wipes his hand off, you know.
Right, right. I never thought of it that way.
Great
but that,
soundtrack too.
Yes, absolutely.
More than just the Springsteen song. That whole soundtrack's great.
Mm-hmm. What else is on that soundtrack?
Thank you for making me.
There's a Neil Young song
that's great.
Okay.
I
don't like Springsteen at all, but I love that song.
City of Brotherly Love. Hey, that's exactly how it sounds.
that's my Neil Young impression.
Yeah. You know, it's
that's pretty good.
It actually works perfectly.
That's also the song. That's what he sings, the melody, everything.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But yeah, Philadelphia is one of my favorite on here. And if I may be so biographical about this, I grew up much like Jeremy did, you know, grew up in a household that was taught this was wrong and everything. And that's it. Now, I'm not going to say this movie totally just changed my mind about things, because you know, it still was another like 10 years. I had to actually interact with gay people. Russell at our at our theater was a you know, big breakthrough too. And it took forever for me to get to that point where I'm like, you know, what was I concerned about here? And Philadelphia, though, was one of those early seeds, because that's, you know, you realize there's a human drama here and everything. And so I consider Philadelphia to be one of those movies for me. You know, Brokeback Mountain was probably the one that bookended that. And, you know, eventually you're just like, okay, I don't know what I was being concerned about here. But yeah, I love that movie. Rent, obviously,
I love this movie so much.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen both the play and the movie.
Only one had Drew Lachey, though.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That is correct.
This used to be an ungoogleable movie, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Rent movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, God, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Rent musical.
And Drew Lachey was fabulous in that role.
That's what you said.
Yeah, he was totally good.
I tried to see if there's any coverage for my upcoming sequel to my book, and I Googled Strings Book. That's also a useless Google, is my point.
Oh, that's a useless Google.
Yeah. Find a bunch of books about strings.
Our
author's name String.
Our next episode will be about ungoogleable entertainment. We'll start with It, and then then there's Rocky Horror Picture Show, which we talked about. A Single Man. I never saw this. This has Colin Firth was in this.
Yep. Colin Firth. We were just talking about him from The Favorite.
Nicholas Holt. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. He's the one that kind of revives him.
Right.
He's a prostitute, I think. Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This is a good movie, I think.
Yeah.
I remember it being good. I've only seen it once.
I was told
it's very dramatic.
I've never seen it, but I was.
This is what, 2009?
Somewhere around there, because A Serious About Man came out the same year.
Yes,
oh my God.
Yes.
And so it was one of those things where you're like.
Which is a Coen Brothers film, and you always got confused.
Yeah, got very confused. Yeah. Because I would call. I would definitely invert them during that time.
So the gay film or the Jewish film?
it was pretty much that, yeah. Then we have Summertime. I've never seen this. You've seen this.
Cécile de France is in this.
Yeah?
It is a... Okay. I mean, I'm coming from a straight male perspective, but this didn't get to porny level to me. It is a very... It's a French film. Belgian film. That she depicted a very tender relationship between two women. And honestly, I don't know. I think there's some nudity in it, but there's not it's not salacious at all to me. It is beautiful, though. It's very much like Call Me By Your Name in terms of the imagery and stuff like that.
Cool.
It's a good one.
And rounding out this list, you have Carol written down, which I've seen. I don't remember much about it.
Why did a C-movie show up at the end of this fucking
list? Yeah, I don't either. It's Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara. And if I remember correctly, Cate Blanchett is...
Oh, I saw this.
Is a wealthy, and she doesn't want to be found out about this. And that's the story is she keeps putting Rooney Mara back, even though she's obviously in love with her and everything.
Nobody puts Rooney in a corner.
Nobody does. If there was any movie on this list underneath, I would want to talk about, it would be The Imitation Game. Have you seen it yet?
No, but I read about it and I did not realize the ending to that story.
Yeah, the Turing is it Alan Turing?
Yeah, Alan Turing.
Alan Turing, I mean the movie is about how he breaks the German codes, obviously, but there's also in Great Britain at the time it was illegal to be gay. And he was found out. And they ruined his life essentially. And I don't know when that. I mean, obviously, Great Britain is ahead of us when it comes to being progressive and everything. I don't know when they decided to remove those laws, but
I don't know either. Same thing happened to Oscar Wilde, though.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
There's a specific charge in Britain that I was reading about that's like being criminally salacious or something like that. And the sentence is chemical castration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the I guess the title card from what I was reading, or the end card, said that like 49,000 men were sentenced to this and had that happen. And I'm like, oh. Because when you think about the Turing test and you think about Alan Turing and all that stuff, I had no idea about any of this
It's a thing in The Imitation Game. Just from an art perspective, you wonder if it needed to be included into this. Because it's about his code breaking more than it is anything else. Mm. And that part is more of a coda to the whole movie.
It's almost like Lincoln, where the movie's all about this one piece of legislation, and then at the end, don't forget, he was assassinated later.
Yeah, 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 right.
Because it's a story about Lincoln, we have to talk about that.
But I mean, I think it has to be in there because it's not like you're going to make another Alan Turing movie
right
after. You kind of have to cover that ground, but they sort of dance around it when he's hanging out with Keira Knightley throughout the movie, and does he marry her? I don't even remember if he marries her or what, but she knows he's gay, and it's sort of just as a front and everything. But and I don't know, it that part of it sort of comes out of nowhere because we're taken through this intrigue of him figuring all this out, and then, oh yeah, by the way, he was chemically castrated for his. Yeah.
Is this a good movie?
I've had to go back and forth on that one. Not sure. The him cracking the code and everything, that's exciting.
It seems interesting.
It's long after he's had his service and everything, and these people visit him. These two like soldiers or detectives or whatever visit him at his apartment. And they ask him questions, and then I think they're convinced by the time they leave that he's gay, and so they're going to have to do something. But I haven't seen it in a while, obviously. But it's just one of those things. It seems like a coda at the end, but the movie's good. The movie's good. I'm going to say it's good.
All right.
Imitation Game is good just because of like what he has to do to solve all this, and some of the moral quandaries I guess it's a moral or ethical decision in there where they crack the code, but they can't do it right away.
Oh,
because right. If they do, then the Germans will know that they know.
Right.
And I'm sure this didn't happen in real life, but they have to make it dramatic in the movie. Someone on his team is like, my brother is on one of those ships. You have to tell them, or blah, blah, blah. And he's like, no, we can't do that because the whole war will be lost that way. You know, that's one of the best scenes in the movie, even though it probably didn't happen. but yes, we will have to do this again sometime. There's a lot more, obviously, to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
There's more than just the movies themselves, but just there's bad representations. And then people, there are movies that try to, I mean, that we could talk a whole podcast on bad representations. I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We would like to thank Dave Irwin for
showing
up.
Thank you guys.
And giving us your perspective on this and everything. And yes, we will definitely revisit this at some point.
I really appreciate the first part of this. The historical relevance and the fact that you guys both know the celluloid closet so well. That was on one of the ones that I could see on every list. Like, you know, this is an important one. I'm going to. I'm glad that you guys, that was a nice leaping off point because it seems like that informs a lot of what came before and what came after.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for doing this episode. I mean, like I said earlier, it's all about visibility, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, it's... the LGBT community, even in 2019, is still a very, very small minority represented in film. It's getting better. It's getting better. But yeah, I appreciate you doing an episode about this.
Yeah, and we're glad to do it. But we should probably do it more. Like I said, we're going to probably try to find
a way. There is a lot more to talk about.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For sure. That's why, like, by the end of this, I'm sitting here going, man, there's so many other things.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
But this is, this is ripe for revisiting over and over. So, okay, so that's going to do it for this this week. Keep going to Sincast presented by CinemaSins on Facebook. There's a CinemaSins Twitter, MVS Twitter. We have a Discord. I may have to give you a private link to that. If you want to come on Facebook and ask for one, I'm usually around to give you one.
It's a direct feed to Chris's bedroom.
That's correct. Yes. It's like Big Brother Chris edition.
Chris edition.
He's laying in bed checking his phone.
What's up, guys?
Yeah. That'll do it for this week. It's Chris Atkins and Jeremy Scott, Barrett Scherer, and David Irwin. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.
Dave, Jeremy wrote a book. He actually wrote two books.
Okay.
And one is out. One was out in June, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's been out for a while. And then the sequel to it is coming out in September.
I actually wrote three books, but the first one was shit.
I've never read that first one.
Well, and you probably won't unless Chris slides it to you on the down low.
I probably don't have that anymore. I wouldn't think.
Was it on a file or you didn't print it, did you?
Well, we were... Actually,
because it was 2004.
Yeah,
but I was the using only a reason email. I remember that. Only reason I remember that is you brought up. I had not heard of Team America at the time. It might have been 2003. Even Team America came out in 2004, but I think the trailer for Team America had come out, and you said, "Have you seen this new trailer that Trey Parker and Matt Stone, this new movie?" And I was like, "No, I had no idea they were making a movie." Yeah. And I remember. Watching that trailer at your British Woods apartment.
Yeah, yeah. And now you can quote that movie in your sleep.
I can.
It sounds very nice.
British Woods. But it was actually a really nice apartment really? Complex.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
But I don't know anymore. It was gated, had a pool.
Ooh.
But yeah, that book was time travel based.
Yes. Set in Nashville.
Mm-hmm. Set in Nashville.
And I think in hindsight, I don't want to write any time travel stories because they all fall apart.
They're hard.
Yeah.
They're hard.
They are, man.
My main character walks into his lab. He's trying to find time travel and he's failing. Walks into his lab and somebody has written the formula on the chalkboard for him. Huh. Thus, he creates time travel. By the end of the book, he hates that he did that. So he goes back in time and erases the chalkboard just before he walks in the room to see it. That doesn't work.
Well, depending on your timeline logic, if you're using Avengers Endgame logic, then...
I'm saying there's no time travel logic that makes that work. It's just a very cool visual of him wiping the board clean, and then he disappears because he doesn't exist anymore, and the eraser falls to the ground.
But then, that is a very good visual. But then who wrote it in the first place? Tony Stark?
No, his nemesis, his business partner nemesis.
Oh, I'm spoiling the book.
It's not.
I want to read it.
No, I would be embarrassed to have you read that book. I would rather let you read some of the sins I write late at night when I'm drunk that the next morning I have to erase. I had a reason I wrote that, but I just was like, nope, not even going to look at the footage. Taking that one out. Normally, I don't start the session with like revealing terrible jokes that I wrote.
There are times where things pop in your head and you'll want to write it down and you're like, I better not. Yep. It's just no.
Yep.
Constantly.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are a couple of people livid about that Louis Tomlinson joke, just so you know.
Oh, really?
Whoever wrote that.
That was me. Yeah.
Appreciate that.
What?
In Shazam. Have you seen Shazam?
Yes.
So we did the CinemaSins video for Shazam. It was me and Aaron, I think, that wrote on it. And there's a part where it's a really good movie, I think. Oh, yeah. There's a part where dude is storming off. And he's like, name me a good sidekick or a cool sidekick. And the guy can't come up with an answer. And so the narration is like Louis Tomlinson, referencing in particular the fan fiction episode from Euphoria, mm-hmm. where they have you seen Euphoria
I
at all? The
not.
Show?
I actually have not.
They
so.
she writes one of the characters writes fan fiction about Harry Styles and Louis Tomlinson.
Okay.
Behind the scenes, like he's super nervous, and so Harry agrees to relax him. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder, there's no way that they get that subtext, by the way, right? Like the people that are mad about it, they're just mad because we made a One Direction joke.
Yeah, those are the ones that I love. People get outraged about, and they don't know why they're outraged.
Yep. Well, they don't know why they're. It's true.
I guess they know why they're outraged, but you know, they don't really. You know, they don't know why the sin was written or what the purpose behind it was.
It's the words.
It's like Adele, right? When we did Adele,
yeah, exactly.
How do you sound in your cans there? Sound okay?
Sounds fine. What was the SNL episode with Tom Hanks as the roadie for Aerosmith?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Sibilance. testing, sibilance.
It puts all the scarves on there. And
yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder how they did that. I don't remember how they got Aerosmith to play Wayne's Basement.
Well, they were the musical guests on the
episode. Right, exactly, of course. But I'm just wondering, like, within the narrative
in the
of the
world.
Show.
In Aurora, Illinois, did they get Aerosmith to agree to be on the show?
Yeah.
I need to watch that episode again.
Yeah.
Most popular public access television show.
And we could say the same thing about the North Pole and Polar Express, right?
Yeah. By the way, I watched, speaking of Deadeyes, I watched Tron Legacy again a couple days ago.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I watch that movie, it gets a little more and more Uncanny Valley with Clue and Jeff Bridges.
Oh,
well,
that's true. Well, if only because... Now, it was when it came out.
It was, but I bought it more when it came out. But I was like, man, that's
because
amazing.
Because they improved the technology.
Yeah.
It's like watching Monster House when John and I both wrote like 10 jokes about how shitty the animation was. This was only like 15 years ago.
Yeah, no, that animation is...
No, but Tron Legacy is my shit.
Mm-hmm. The animation's all crappy. Mm-hmm.
I like to take drugs and watch that movie.
Yeah, I've watched it way too many times now.
Yeah, I've probably seen it a dozen times.
And I watch Passengers again. We're starting to get like same brain.
That? Why did you do that?
I can't wait to see your cut, though, man, because I was cutting it myself in my brain.
What fascinates me is how many times I've tweeted about it and how many people still didn't understand what that tweet meant. Like 85% of the responses had no clue I was recutting it, and that's what I was watching. They just thought I was watching the movie.
Mm. Have you seen Passengers?
I have not.
The Chris Pratt, Jennifer Lawrence.
Oh, the Jennifer Lawrence
from 2016.
Yes, but I have to admit I was a little bit drunk when we went and saw it.
Perfect way to see it.
So I don't remember anything about it except for the fact that Jennifer Lawrence was a little bit rapey towards Chris Pratt, I guess.
Or the other way around.
It was the other way around.
Okay.
Well, yes. Yes.
Depends on how you
rapey,
look
murdery,
at it.
Rapey, murdery, yes. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. But it's a fascinating movie, even though it's bad. So Jeremy's going to recut it to where
it's a fascinating movie about an unhealthy relationship that is portrayed to be healthy.
Yes.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
That was a bad joke. Will you cut that?
I was on the Behind the Scenes last week. And Danae was talking about some comment in the Pulp Fiction video that we did where they said that, Uma Thurman, she's half goddess and half tree frog or something like that.
Oh, this was a comment?
Yeah. And I was like, I'm instantly reminded that, like, so many times women I find gorgeous and have no flaws, there's always people out there that find something like that I would have never thought of, yep. and still wouldn't even afterwards.
That's why there's that meme guy who I think first time I ever saw it was in the comments section of Ain't It Cool News, but it's the guy who doesn't like that actress because her knees are too pointy.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen that?
No.
I've seen it recycled a whole bunch. Like before Twitter, it was like, oh, her knees are too pointy. I don't like her. I think that's making fun of that kind of scrutinizing a goddess.
Totally makes sense.
Half tree frog.
Yeah. When I was, I brought up the thing where I was like, I talked about how I brought up Lauryn Hill in a conversation of gorgeous women, and two of my friends were like, nah, she's not all that attractive.
That's
and I was like, are you serious?
Man.
Lauryn Hill?
They must not have seen the second Sister Act.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Or the first one.
You have
no,
to.
It's the second one.
It's the second one.
Yeah, you have to see. You have to see the second Sister Act to really know.
Back in the habit.
She's all. She's gorgeous in that movie,
yeah,
though.
She is. She's gorgeous in general, but
she's still gorgeous.
If not just for the performances of I'm sinking. My chair fell. If not for the performances of Jim Carrey and Ewan McGregor.
Yeah. There you go.
Okay. Sorry. I was sinking.
Yes.
You're going to edit that out, right?
I needed an old priest and a young priest.